This talk comes from www.euroleadershipresources.org. The European Leadership Forum is a bridge between local Christian leaders' needs and God's global resources. Hundreds of hours of key Christian thinking. Go to www.euroleadershipresources.org and sign up to receive details of more resources that can support your ministry.
Yeah, right. I hear you. Well, and actually, I'm excited about this. I actually love the opportunities to kind of interact and rope. I'll just kind of slide this over here and back. What time is coffee break scheduled for? What time is the coffee break scheduled for?
Okay, break starts at
10:30. Okay, did you have a list of registrants here? Do you know how many were supposed to be in?
I don't think we have anybody that signed up for these.
I signed up online.
Yeah.
I think pretty much, I don't have a list. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll just wait a few seconds and... Tyndall Theological Seminary, you're with Henry and the crowd from Amsterdam. I understand that when I flew into Amsterdam the other day, I was within a stone's throw, depending upon the... Is that right? From the airport? I haven't flown into Amsterdam in years. It used to be that I would come to Europe, and that kind of was the... Especially if you're flying with KLM, that was kind of the... obviously, the focal point of... Yeah. Kind of the focal point of Europe and...
Well, they're working hard to be, the gateway airport.
Yeah, it's really changed quite a bit. Actually, it's a little bit more, I think, traveler hospitable, perhaps, than it was years ago. And actually, I would prefer, I mean, Frankfurt to me is a rather, it's such a spread out, you have at least comfortable environments,
right.
That have been created, the shops and so forth, make it really quite...
Yeah, a lot of people really think that's their favorite airport to go through. It's a nice airport.
Yeah.
It just keeps growing. They had this big debate several years ago.
I need one of those too, if I could.
Or they would build another airport. And actually, the plan was to build an airport out on the ocean. But they scrapped that idea and decided to just keep expanding the one that's already there.
Well, what's there is still underground. I mean, below sea level, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like most of the Netherlands. Yeah, exactly.
But the problem is, of course, it's all surrounded by villages, and there's nowhere to go, hardly. They keep having to buy up farmland.
Right.
Because they've added two runways just in the recent past. And they're still doing all the infrastructure to connect all those things.
Sure.
It just keeps going.
I was pretty amazed, when you come in, all the greenhouses. And, of course, it kind of is obviously reflective of a lot of what it is that we think of when we think of the Netherlands, the tulips and, the agricultural. And my wife and I took a cruise this year. We went on the Holland America from Barcelona up throughout the Mediterranean and ended up in Rome. And every day, and I guess that's a practice of Holland American cruises, every day you have fresh flowers. And I mean, it's something that's so delightfully unique about
the
culture.
That's the only thing there
that's a bargain. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it is.
By American, that's that and cheese. Cheese is inexpensive by American standards. Very good cheese and flowers are great. I passed the stand just the other day where you could get 20 roses for €3.
Oh, my. So I ought to stop when I'm... Well, actually, when I'm going through Frankfurt, I was going to say that'd be a good thing to do on the way home. I could come home with a nice bouquet of roses, and my wife would think that I was just the most sensitive, caring, loving...
Well, they haven't priced this a lot in the airport, but when you go out to the markets and things, you get you know, flowers or something the average person can buy constantly.
So it's not really a treat for your wife. I mean, she knows that you really, she
yeah,
knows
she has
what
flowers
you.
Flowers all the time. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. I mean, yeah. Especially when I buy the wrong kind, anyways.
Yeah. Well, I understand.
I tend to want to drop.
Yes. See, I figure if we wait a little bit longer, we'll keep getting people to show up here.
I tend to have allergic reactions to flowers, so. Don't. Some of these flowers are around the house, and I sneeze all the time.
Right.
But they're pretty.
Oh, you can't go with that fire. Yeah, come on. We want you closer. Yeah, we want you closer. This is going to be, we believe in warm and cozy here. So now, these are the presents that you're taking back.
Books.
Books, huh? Yeah. Boy, the book sales were pretty impressive.
Yeah, for Europe, that's precious.
The Eastern Europeans, especially, you know, find the books to be quite, you know, it's like they're in a candy store, you know, like, oh, man. One of the fellows that was the volunteers goes to my church in Indianapolis, and we go to a church that is kind of unique, you know, it's a fairly large church, but, you know, and fairly affluent. It's in a area of the city where, you know, seems to be a lot of people that have done quite well. And they tend to be a bit satisfied and content in their own little worlds, you know. And he came here and he said to me, he says, everybody in our church needs to just see the book table, you know, and the rush, you know, for people to basically get things that are not available to them in their own country. So why don't we close the door, Ben, and we'll begin. Let's tell me about you and your ministry and what it is that you do. And
my name is Paweł Kugler. I'm from Poland. I work as an intern at the Baptist Church.
Okay.
In Gdańsk, north on the Baltic coast. The church is small. It's newly planted. It's about 25 members now. In general, there are very few evangelicals in Poland. Maybe 100,000. It's a Catholic country.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm also here. I was in the scientific network. I'm involved in. We started last year something called the Forum for Dialogue Between Science and Religion.
Mm-hmm.
In Gdańsk. And because creationists' views are completely unknown in Poland, so we try to show that there is alternative to the common view. So that's why I'm here.
Is there, in the Catholic Church in your area, I know that in many places in Poland there's some level of evangelical activity even among, you know, Catholics. Is that, would that be true in your area? Or?
Yes, but it's difficult really because these people are usually very confused.
Mm-hmm.
what should they believe? On one hand, they have the Bible, but on the other hand, they are strongly bound to the church, which, by definition, says different things. So, but often these groups, after their understanding grows, they would split from the church.
Uh-huh.
And become separate congregations.
Uh-huh.
It's there, but these groups have also different profiles. Some of them are more charismatic. Usually, most of them are emphasizing the
spiritual gifts.
Yeah, the role of the Holy Spirit. But they have also a strong cult for Mary. So it's all mixed.
Right, yeah. Right. Tyndale Seminary has how many students, and what is your role there?
Well, I'm the academic dean, and also teach Hebrew and Old Testament.
We have around 30 resident full or part-time students, and then an odd collection of another probably 40 that just take courses. So that's the profile.
And the school is how old?
Started in 85.
Okay.
So we're celebrating our 20th year this year, and also in the midst of some significant paradigm shifts in how we operate and what we offer people. So this last year was the last year that we have the MDiv program. We have a handful of people who have another year to complete that, but the traditional program won't be there the next year. They'll have to kind of put together their final year through the courses that are being offered otherwise. So,
now, what degree are you? Do you offer a terminal degree? Or?
We're going now to Master of Arts in Evangelical Theology, 2-year MA, and a Master in Intercultural Studies, 1-year.
Both MAs?
Both MAs, yeah.
Okay. And no, nothing beyond that?
Nothing beyond that, no.
And the reason for making those changes? Was the MDiv program a 3-year program?
Yeah, it looks like the state's typical MDiv program. In fact, it started as an exact replica of Trinity's MDiv program. In fact, our first catalog was almost a photocopy of Trinity's catalog, because our founding president was a former professor at Trinity.
And who was that?
Art Johnston.
Okay.
Well, the reason for the changes is we began realizing that a lot of students that come to us from a Bible college.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what they get in the MDiv is reduplicated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not exactly, but still it isn't a big advance. It is maybe some courses. They probably didn't get Hebrew in their Bible college, but a lot of it is similar to what they've gotten already.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the focus of our school, at least since 1990, has been Eastern Europeans.
Hmm.
And they're the ones that come with this condition. There's increasingly reluctance to let Eastern Europeans get to the West for that long among the people that make those decisions. Part of our reason for existing is to stop the brain drain to America.
Right.
And to have that kind of training available in Europe so that the person doesn't have to go outside of Europe for that training. And in that context, it's very hard to hang around, study, get your studies, you go back. Still, a lot of Eastern European leaders think that 3 years in the West is too long to be out of their context and, in a sense, get thoroughly Westernized. So we think we can serve them better with a program that mixes residence and extension training and only take them out of their country for 9 months.
Mm-hmm. Over 9 months.
Well, September to May.
Right, for 2 years.
No, the second year can be done in extension.
Okay.
It can all be done through extension work. It's only the first year.
They have to be in residence.
They have to be in residence. And some people will have enough training that they don't need the courses that year. They could just do the second year by distance or in residence if they prefer. But we're setting it up so that if someone wants or needs to do it by extension, they can.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the students that come to us will have to have the first year of residence, that they won't have that extensive training. So most people will, by default, have to be there for that first residential year. That year also involves a certain set of courses that the Free University of Amsterdam require students have for their programs. So if someone needs a state-accredited Master of Theology or PhD, then if they've taken that first year of our MA with us, they're eligible to transfer to the free university and get a THM or go in for a PhD.
Great.
And it's all in English.
Are you getting positive responses to the changes, or
Well, we don't know yet. It's, you know, this September is the launching of it. That'll be the first time we actually begin this new program. We're also dealing with the accreditation issue. We've never been accredited until recently. In the early days, our founding president didn't think accreditation was necessary. And in some ways, it wasn't then. But when accreditation came up as an issue, he wanted to get accredited by the Dutch Ministry of Education. And we're just outside their loops, so they just won't really talk to us. We can't be, well, it's not true now, it has been true up until a couple years ago, that there's no one in the United States that will accredit you because you're not in the United States. Now apparently there's at least one regional agency that will do schools outside the United States.
Which one's that?
It's the North.
North Central?
Yeah.
Which is really the largest one.
Yeah. So I don't know that if we will ever fall back on that. In the meantime, we've decided that any accreditation is better than no accreditation.
Sure.
So we've just had our MDiv, ironically enough, it's stopping. We had a team come from the European Evangelical Accrediting Association. And all we offered them was our two new MA programs, because that's what we need to get accredited. And they said, well, why don't you offer your MDiv? So we're going to stop offering it. They said, well, we can at least offer it for the last group of students. So we did. We threw that into the mix. And then at their meeting in May, they approved, they accredited the MDiv, but they didn't accredit the two new programs, except provisionally. They, it's all very confusing if you know anything that was happening in education with the Bologna situation. There's all this supposed centralized movement towards an educational system that all the countries will agree to, but they don't agree.
Right.
So on the one hand, you're told that if you're not fitting the rules of Bologna, you don't fit. Yet the big countries flagrantly oppose those things. And who knows? No one knows what's going to come out in the end.
Right.
Whether the Bologna thing will be compromised or what. So in the meantime, we've started this process of accreditation with EAA. Our two master's programs should be accredited by them next May. And the reason I brought that up about Bologna was that they themselves, the EAA itself, is trying to get now accepted into a secular European-wide group, and they have to change all their manuals and forms, so they can't really, although there's a debate between the Continentals and the Brits on this, but they couldn't come to a consensus that they would accredit us at this point. They're going to rewrite their manuals and accredit us based on the new manuals. So we were delayed for a year in that, and in the meantime, we're also planning to submit papers to what's now called the NVAO, the Netherlands Flemish Accrediting Organization, because those things exist now for groups like us. They didn't exist in the past, so you don't have to try to go to the Ministry of Education. You go to one of these state-approved agencies. But it's all evolving and in flux, and so you're constantly not sure what the rules are. But that's where we stand on that. And so we're just at that point of just now being able to say that we're a candidate for accreditation, and we've just started. One reason we're at this conference is to, for PR purposes mainly.
Sure.
And to try to get the word out throughout Europe about our new programs.
Good. How long have you been in Amsterdam?
17 years.
And where are you from originally?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Whereabouts?
Greensboro.
Greensboro. Okay. Pretty country out through there. Mm-hmm. So. And see, let's get the first names here. Your first name is?
Pavel.
Pavel? P-A-V-E-L? Pavel? Close, huh? And
Craig.
Craig.
C-R-A-I-G?
E-I-G.
E-I-G, okay. Craig, okay. And?
Chris.
Chris. I have a son named Chris, so that should be easy for me to remember. And Chris represents he's a physician, represents the, I'll let you tell because I'm not going to do a good job.
I work as a gastroenterologist in internal medicine in Manchester, UK. I chair the Christopher Mann Fellowship in the UK, so for me that's a sort of honorary position. And it's a 2-year term office, which finishes in about a week.
Oh!
I'm forward to setting that down. And we have about 5,000 doctor members, about 1,000 medical students, and our activities are broad in various areas. So we would support and encourage overseas ministry, so support doctors to go to the developing world. We would try and train and equip doctors to live as Christians within the UK environment. We're currently running a training program called the Saline Solution, which we borrowed from the States, which is all about helping healthcare professionals to share faith in a sensitive and appropriate way with their patients in a professional context. So it's for many, that's a big cultural jump because the doctor-patient relationship is traditionally there's been some nervousness about sharing faith there because of ethical issues about is it appropriate if you've got vulnerable patients to do that, issues to do with what would my professional organization think, what would my colleagues think about this sort of thing, so there are sort of cultural resistances and barriers. But from a personal point of view, that's always been a passion of mine, is to see faith and work integrated to live and work properly as a Christian medicine. What else do? We have an engagement with the media, so we try and engage with legislation and media on a number of the modern debates, euthanasia being a big example for us at the moment. In terms of organisational size, we now, as I was saying earlier, dealing with a budget of about £1 million a year, staff of about 20, I should think, altogether. So that's, in a nutshell, what CMF is all about. Mm-hmm.
And the $1 million budget, or the £1 million budget a year, basically, there are staff obligations, obviously. What are your primary expenses as an organization? Staffing.
Yeah, mostly staff.
The conferences that you do are pretty much self-sustaining?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. And staffing, responsibilities, any?
We have a full-time general secretary who's chief executive officer, I suppose, who's medically qualified, because that's Peter Saunders. We have an associate general secretary who's medically qualified, we have a student secretary who's generally qualified. We have a number of more junior doctors who come through for like a 1-year period.
Mm-hmm.
They take a year aside from their career, come and do that. And then we have staff in the office to support what's going on. We have an overseas secretary who is also medically qualified. We've just appointed a new communications officer whose job it's going to be, we think, to really take hold of this public voice type of work that seems to be increasing for us, the engagement with the media especially. So that's the sort of spread of people that we've got.
Good. Okay. Well, why don't we pray together, and then let's get into talking about how we might be able to be more effective, perhaps, in impacting others and the ways that really our ministries are intended to do that. And so let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time you've given us together. Thanks for bringing us all here. And I pray that this session might be a good wrap-up of so much of what it is that's already happened here in our lives at the Forum. We're thankful for the privilege of being able to be together with so many different people from so many different countries, representing so many different ministries, all with a heart and a passion to really reach people in more effective ways so that the gospel of Christ can have its effect on generations of people who so desperately need to hear the message of your redemptive love. So, Lord, we pray that what it is that you've begun here this week might continue in the hearts and the lives of those individuals that have been present, that as they leave and take their places again in ministries so far away from here and in environments that are so different than what it is that they perhaps have experienced here over these last few days, that you would give them encouragement, that you'd give them hope, that you'd give them vision, that you'd give them a plan to essentially take what it is that they've learned and to disseminate it to others. Lord, we just ask your blessing upon this time that we've had together, or this time together that we shall have, and we ask, Heavenly Father, that you would use it for your glory and to that, and we'll give you praise. We pray in your name. Amen. A little bit of background as to what it is that I've been doing for the last 35 years. I am a product of New England, which, for those of you that are familiar with the United States, the northeast part of our country. I grew up in a family of fishermen, actually. My father was a lobsterman. My grandfather was a lobsterman. My uncles were all fishermen, and my cousins are all fishermen. I get horribly seasick, so I had to figure out something else to do with my life. You know, just watching the ocean on a rough day can be a disturbing gastronomical experience, and so. But anyway, I grew up in a family that deeply loved the Lord and were very, very committed to Christ. Lay people, you know, just fishermen. My mother, you know, stayed home with my sisters and I. But I can't remember a time when Christ wasn't mentioned in our family. I have one of those wonderful privileges of just having experienced exposure to not only the message of the gospel, but the practice of the gospel. My parents were real practitioners in very, very commendable ways. If there were needs in our community, my parents would be probably the first to respond. The front door was always open, and the living room was always filled, and it wouldn't be unusual at all to have numbers of people sitting at the table for a meal, and even though we may not have had much, what it is that they had, they were certainly willing to share. And, you know, reflectively, I look back at that, and I think, well, that was, normative, you know, in our family. But, you know, the older I've become, I realize that what it is that I experienced was really not normal at all. It was really rather the exception, perhaps, than the rule. But, you know, interestingly enough, having been exposed to the message of the gospel most of my life, I did invite Christ into my life about 275 times, only because I couldn't figure out how you could still sin and have Jesus in your heart, you know. So I'm just wanting to make sure that I've got this thing right, you know. And it wasn't until I was a teenager that I really came to the understanding, I think, of what it is that Paul or whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, and I actually don't think it was Paul. I'm memorizing, my wife and I are trying to memorize the book of Hebrews, and we've memorized other large portions of Scripture, and, you know, the structure certainly doesn't, match up a lot of the other Pauline epistles in terms of the way the structure is, at least in the English text, But nonetheless, when Paul was, or whomever was writing to Hebrew Christians, he said, you know, it's time to move on, you know, to leave the elementary things and move on to, you know, meat and so forth. And I think probably as a 15-year-old, that became very apparent to me. I went to a camp as a staff member. And there was a campfire service, and there were actually about 600 people at this camp, so it wasn't really like a small camp. And there was a challenge for us to commit our lives to the Lord. And that was kind of a new concept to me. I mean, I already committed my heart to Christ, but, I mean, they were talking about something that was just totally foreign to me. And we were invited to come forward and to make that commitment. And I did, along with about 125 others. And I remember reaching down, there were some sticks next to the fire, and we were asked to take one of those sticks and kind of throw it into the fire. And the stick was to represent our life and the fire, obviously, the world in which we were going. And essentially I said, Lord, here's my life, and whatever you want to do with it, then you're free to do that. But I was 15, you know, and what do you know when you're 15 years old? You know, you think you know everything, but I'm not sure that I really understood what that meant in terms of what it would mean from a vocational standpoint. I knew that I wanted to do nothing more in my life than to serve the Lord, but I didn't know what that meant. I thought probably it meant going to the mission field or being a pastor or doing something, you know, in that nature. And in the context of time, I went on to Bible school in a Bible college situation at Miami Bible College in Florida, which for those of you that are familiar with the geographics of America, that's warm in Florida and it's cold in Maine, you know. So the first catalog I ever saw from Miami Bible College showed students underneath a palm tree next to the ocean studying the Bible, and I'm saying, here am I, Lord, you know, send me. I really think that this is what it is that you'd have me to do with my life. And so I went to Miami, and then I went to Grace Theological Seminary in Indiana to do graduate work, and then was teaching. And in the context of teaching, I went to a small Bible institute to teach, and there were only two faculty members. It was actually just beginning. So everybody, you know, not only taught, you know, everything that nobody else wanted to teach, we kind of split up all the courses, and so I'll teach this, and you teach this, and that kind of a thing. But I also was the student recruiter. I was also the public relations guy. I was also the fundraising guy, and my colleague was all the other things, and so I kind of did the developmental side of things, and he did a lot of the academic planning and so forth. He was a West Point grad, which is one of our military academies, and, you know, quite adept in certain areas that I didn't have experience. And so it was really a nice match. But nonetheless, I tended to show some level of effectiveness in doing kind of the developmental things. And I wanted to go back to Grace to do some graduate work or postgraduate work. And so I went back in the mid-70s, and they hired me to work in the development department. You know, basically it was one of those situations, well, if you work here, you know, you can get free tuition. So, I mean, I put the two and two together and came up, I think, with the right answer. And so I started doing development work, and I've never left. I've spent the last, 35 years of my life, for all practical purposes, in institutional advancement and organizational advancement. You know, typically the field has to do with, you know, if you were to talk about development in America 10 or 15 years ago, people would have just basically assumed you were a fundraiser. And it was always kind of interesting, you know, when people, you know, meet you, they say, well, here's Jerry Twombly, and he's a development person. And people just kind of step back about three paces, you know, and then they kind of reach back. They want to know where their wallet is. They just want to make sure that it's protected. Or a lady will reach down to her purse and kind of put her hand around it just to make sure that she's not being fleeced for something that necessarily she doesn't want to give away. But development obviously includes so much more. It includes the things that we do to, obviously, to raise dollars, but the public relational aspects of what it is organizations are concerned about, you know, fall under the development umbrella. Database management, you know, maintaining data and information on people with whom you're building relationships, pretty important. Strategic planning. And so, you know, the profession has broadened to meet the needs of organizations like the organizations that you represent. But unfortunately, for lack of a better term, and this is all leading somewhere, so unfortunately, there has not been an awful lot of training available, at least in the early years of this profession. When I started in development in 1970, it was almost, you know, Christian organization had to learn how to spell the word, to say nothing about, you know, trying to figure out what it meant. There were articles that were appearing in national publications that were talking about things that were happening in the public sector. Harvard University reported a $1 billion endowment. Well, all of a sudden, all the Christians who have been kind of sitting on the sidelines thinking that development was non-spiritual are beginning to ask some pretty serious questions, like what happened at Harvard? And so I was among the first wave of people that were ever hired in development. And nobody knew what the profession was. I asked my first boss what I was supposed to do, and he says, well, raise money. And I said, well, how much? And he says, a lot. That was the only instruction that I ever got. And so I'm trying to figure out what it is that I'm supposed to do. And so most of us that were in that wave of, you know, most of us aren't there anymore. Interestingly enough, tenure in our profession is about 2 years. You know, you just kind of, you know, because there's no education that had been available in those early years, unless you were just terribly tenacious, as I think I was, and determined to learn this field, which I recognized was so important to the ability of an organization to be able to sustain itself. If you weren't tenacious, you know, the realities are you'd go back and do something else. I have a golden retriever, which is my best pal, and she's getting old now. She thinks that she was born to do two things. One is to play tug of war, and the other one is to chase balls. And so she loves doing both. But I think of tenacity. When I think of tenacity, I think of my golden retriever, because we take this little, you know, pull toy, and she will pull until, you know, all night long, and she'd never let go. And I think I feel, when I think of tenacity, that's what I think of, is the fact that she won't let go of this thing. And I think probably I was just stubborn enough, and that's kind of a little bit of my New England heritage, that I refused to give up. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out the profession. And essentially, within the Christian environment, to start to define it. There's an approach to development that we take that's called relational. And relational development, you know, is not anything that's essentially new. I think, you know, obviously, you know, God had that in mind when he created Eve. You know, he realized that it wasn't good for Adam to be alone, so he created a helpmeet. And I think that the design of the scriptures, you see it being played out not only in the activities in the Old Testament of the construction of the tabernacle and the temple. There are a lot of, you know, large initiatives that were accomplished that were only realized as people came together in community and began to do things. Rebuilding of the wall during the days of Nehemiah, and so many other illustrations. There are just so many of them. The unique design of the church. You know, one of the things that I enjoy telling people is that that God created us purposely and intentionally incomplete. He didn't give us, you know, not any single one of us are the repository of all the gifts that God distributed. And so consequently, we need one another, and God designed us that way. And so what I've tried to do is to take, you know, the concepts of relationships and development and to marry them in a series of models that are going to enable people to be more effective in what it is that they're doing. And so I spend a lot of time talking to people about, you know, relationships. I will tell them that development is all about relationships, and it really has very little to do with money. Development is all about relationships, and it has very little to do with what you have to say. And I speak at a lot of conferences, a lot of pastors' conferences in the United States and other places around the world, and I'll make that statement, and people begin to bristle a little bit, because what it is that we have to say is extremely important, and we know that. I mean, you have an important message to share. You have an important message to share. We all have, you know, a message to share that's extremely important. But the point that I want to make is this, that to the degree that we build relationships, we'll never lack for money. And to the degree that we build relationships, interestingly enough, we'll never lack an audience that will hear us and actually respond to us. It's really kind of interesting. When we think of all of our lives, you know, you're doing what it is that you're doing, and we're all doing the things that we're doing, and we're all probably walking with God at the levels in which we're experiencing that intimate relationship with our Savior because of a bunch of people in the background. I think Paul was thinking about that when he wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2. He says, the things that you've heard from me among many witnesses, commit the faithful men that they'll be able to do the same thing, that the message of the gospel would be perpetuated from generation to generation. And I think that's, you know, the point is that, you know, there have been faithful people in back of every, you know, individual who have kind of prodded them, that have encouraged them, that have kind of nudged them when they needed to be nudged and so forth. And I think we've all experienced the value of relationships, both positively and negatively. I mean, if you look at people who've, you know, turned some pretty unfortunate corners in life, or made the wrong turn at a number of intersections, you know, generally it's because of peer pressure, we call it. But the realities are that it's a relational thing. And so relationships are really pretty important. And so what we've tried to do in the context of development is to kind of define how you go about the process of building relationships and then sustaining those relationships. And so there's a definition that I use, and this is going to make the segue, I think, into where it is that I'd like to take you. But there's a definition that we use in our ministry called, you know, the definition of development. And I define development as the things that we do organizationally to build rational relationships with others. And the point that I want to make is that there are two operative words in this, you know, this definition that are entirely relevant to what it is that we're doing, whatever it is that we're doing. You know, number one is that, you know, we need to build relationships with people. You need to build relationships with doctors and with medical students. You need to build relationships with students. You have parishioners within your congregation and people outside in the community that you're seeking to reach for the Lord. And our effectiveness is going to be directly proportional, and I'm absolutely convinced of this, to our ability to build relationships. I teach periodically at seminaries, and I love to do that in America. And one of the lectures that I do is, you know, there are 10 things that I never learned at seminary that if I had learned those things at seminary, my life would have been totally different. Because I learned to be an exegete. I learned to be able to take a passage of Scripture and to parse verbs and to do all the things that were needed. I knew how to diagram. I knew how to construct sermons. I knew how to do all of those things, but I was a relational pygmy. I had absolutely no capacity whatsoever, no knowledge, no understanding in how to really impact and how to build a relationship with somebody else. And a part of that came from a little bit of my heritage, you know. New Englanders, at least in America, are known as being kind of to themselves. You know, we don't move that quickly beyond our family unit in terms of reaching out to others. Everybody is looked at as being suspect. And so you don't trust anybody, and basically the only people that you can really trust are the people that are closest to you, and the people that are most close to you are obviously your family. And so we tend to be very, very, to ourselves. And so I took my environment into my career and basically never opened up the doors of really allowing too many people in. And it reflected in the early years of my marriage because I pursued someone because I wanted to have a relationship with her, the level of that relationship was really quite unsatisfying for years because I really didn't know how beyond, you know, what it is that I'd experienced in my home to go much further than what it is that I had seen my parents and those in my family go. So development is about relationships. And let me just define a little bit about relationships. And I realize this is so elementary, but yet, nonetheless, it is so important to talk about, especially as we're moving into, you know, a discussion about how relationships can be used to effectively transform culture. But, you know, one of the things that oftentimes I've done with students is I've sat down with them and I said, well, let's talk about, you know, let's think about relationships. Think about, you know, your best friend. You know, people that you're the closest to, people that you, you know, would want to go to if you were facing a crisis, if you had a serious question, or if you had an idea that you'd like to share, who would you go to? And think about those relationships that you really treasure, and think of words that you would use to describe them. I mean, if you could think of a few words to describe the most impacting relationship that you would have, you know, what words would you use? You know, people will typically think about that and they'll say, well, fun. You know, I have fun with my friends. I really do enjoy them. I mean, we get together and we laugh and we talk about things and they're just, you know, enjoyable to be with. But then when we get down to the more serious words to describe the relationship, they'll say, well, I can be vulnerable with my friend. I can be truthful. I can kind of lay it all out and I know that, you know, despite the fact that I may even perceive myself as being a little crazy on this particular idea, I know that they're still going to accept me for who it is that I am. And they're not going to reject me because I'm kind of crazy at that particular point in time. They'll use other words like trust. I can trust my friend. I realize that if I said something that it's going to be, you know, kept within the context of the relationship. And so I feel very free to be able to express myself because of the trust that I have. And all those kinds of wonderful words that we would typically use to describe a very valuable and satisfying relationship. And so I usually will write all those words on a whiteboard or something, and I say, okay, now, how many of you think that those would be the same words that, you know, people within your organization would use to describe the relationship they have with you? How many of you think that all the students in our school, when looking at those words, would say, yeah, that those words describe the kind of relationship that I have, you know, with the university that I go, or the seminary that I go, or these are the words that I would use to describe the relationship that I have, you know, with people within the congregation. And most people, you know, kind of blank out a little bit at that point, because, you know, the realities are we talk about relationships because it's such a comfortable word. I mean, I like to talk about relationships because even the word relationships makes me relax a little bit, because that, yeah, you know, relationships are pretty important, and I really, really enjoy those. And so the challenge that we face institutionally, because it's easy for us to talk about that. The point is that you know how to build relationships with people. If I, you know, came to your community and, you know, I was living in Manchester is where you are, and you know, I showed up at your church on a Sunday morning and you know, you met Sue, I met your wife, we kind of talked to one another, and it might be that you'd go home on the way home and you'd look at your spouse and you'd say, you know, Jerry and Sue, they seem like a pretty nice couple and they just moved to the area. I'd like to get to know them better. I mean, you've done this 1,000 times. You walk into the village where your church is located and you meet people that don't know the Lord and you say, well, gee, they're nice people. You know, I'd like to get to know them better. And you know, we can't explain, you know, the work of the Spirit of God. You know, maybe God brought them in that chemistry, which, you know, we call chemistry, may be a part of the work of the Spirit of God or whatever the case might be. But you'd know how to do that. You know, you might invite me out to dinner after church next Sunday, or you might say, well, listen, why don't we have a coffee together down at the local, you know, coffee shop or whatever, and we'd begin talking and interacting, and we might meet with each other as families and do things together. But we all know how to do that on an individual basis. The challenge that we face, and it's a humongous challenge, practically speaking, is how do you build relationships with hundreds of people in your community? Because if your church is going to be effective in reaching, you know, your community with a redemptive message of Christ, it's going to be most effectively accomplished through relationships. How do we do it with 30 students, you know, in the seminary? How do we do it with 5,000 doctors, you know? I mean, the realities are the challenges really become exacerbated just by virtue of the numbers. And so that's what it is that I think I can help organizations do. And one of our clients, you know, international clients, is Habitat for Humanity. And we do a lot of training for Habitat affiliates around the world to help them to raise the money to build the homes that they do to hopefully impact culture in the ways that they feel called of God to do that. And I was at a meeting not long ago in Americus, Georgia, where the headquarters of Habitat for Humanity, the international headquarters, are located, and someone was saying that we have a database, and it's a big one, and eventually they released the number, just probably more for psychological impact than anything, but the realities are, they said, we have 2 million people on our database. Well, I mean, if you're a development person, you're sitting there scratching your head saying, well, how do you build relationships with 2 million people? Well, I mean, obviously there's ways that that can be done, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on, but it's all about relationships. But it's interesting, you heard me make the statement that it's not about money, it's about relationships. It's not about what it is that you have to say, it's about relationships. And the realities are, to the degree that we build relationships, we'll not lack for money, nor will we lack for an audience to be heard, you know, that will hear us. But conversely, it's kind of interesting. If we lead with our need, in other words, if we lead in our conversations and our communications with people with our need, you know, the need to communicate our message, the need for money, the need for whatever it is that we're looking for, when we lead with our need, we're almost always perceived as being manipulative. In other words, people, you know, I'm an evangelist, and so I want to share the gospel of Christ with you, and so that's my need. I want you to hear what it is that I have to say. And people look at that as that he has an agenda, and I'm not necessarily wanting to follow his agenda. I had this very interesting meeting the other day, and I can't even remember where I do remember where it was. I was meeting with Overseas Council International, which is a large ministry that works with universities and colleges around the world. And there was a fellow there that we were talking about some of these things, and he says, you know, my parents were missionaries in Haiti. And they went to Haiti, the island of Haiti, which is extremely poor, and people struggle just for survival there. And my parents went and they said, you need Jesus as your Savior. And they said, no, we need rice and beans. They said, no, you need the Lord. You need to embrace Christ as your Savior and Lord. No, we need rice and beans. And you know, I thought it was such an incredible illustration, because here we are, you know, with a life-changing message. And here's somebody that we're trying to reach is just saying, just give us rice and beans, for crying out loud. We can't even embrace anything until we at least have our stomachs full. And I think those are the kinds of chasms that exist between where we want to go and the message that we have. And I think that's what we all struggle with. So manipulation is really a motivational issue. James, gives this incredible example in James chapter 2. He says, don't hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. If somebody comes into your assembly with dressed in fine clothes and has this gold ring, and of course we all, every development officer has memorized that passage, because it really does bring to the forefront what it is that we don't want to be. And he says, but there also comes in a poor man dressed in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one dressed in the fine clothes, and you say, why don't you sit here in this good place? And you say to the one dressed in the poor clothes, the dirty clothes, why don't you just stand over here somewhere, sit down underneath my footstool? But I think the next verse is obviously the most significant, when James says, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? I mean, if the motive is just to get from people what it is that we want. And that's so much the motive of development. We need people to give us money. We need people to do this. We need people to do this and so forth. But when we pursue people simply for what it is that they can give to us, apart from the relationship, we probably are being manipulative. And I think those are the kinds of things that every responsible, sensitive, caring Christian development officer needs to address. How do we focus on the relationships? And I realize that it's kind of a fine line in the sand, but the point is, I am absolutely convinced, and when I talk to people about a developmental program, and I'm going to make that transition here, because we're talking about how we take these same developmental principles and apply them in the context of ministry. But in the context of, if I were talking to people about institutional advancement, I would say that I'm absolutely convinced, and I really am, that everybody on earth wants a satisfying relationship. Everybody wants to be a part of community, that because God's designed us that way. There's this innate need to be, and you think about people that, basically have withdrawn from society, but they've probably withdrawn from society because they've never had a satisfying relationship. And so they, tend to go up into the hills somewhere, and in North Carolina, where Craig is from, and basically, vegetate somewhere up in the mountains. But the realities are, God hasn't designed us that way. He's designed us to want community. He's designed us for relationships and so forth. But the realities are that those people that haven't experienced them, may withdraw. But the point is that I think everybody wants them. And I think they want to attach to ministries. I talk to people, about, you're not lacking for people who could come alongside and be a partner with you and helping you to fulfill your ministry. But the realities are, what we lack is a focus. We're focusing upon our need and not necessarily being able to engage people to do things collectively that we can't do alone. And that's the joy of all of ministry. Go on and on about that, but nonetheless, relationships. It's all about relationships. Now, the other word in that definition, which is really important, and it really does bear relevance to where it is that I want to go today, and that's the word rational. Rational, in my definition of it, at least from this in this particular discussion, is reflects objectivity. In other words, I think the antonym, if you please, of rational the opposite would be emotional. I think probably one of the great, great analogies of development is falling in love. In other words, you know, we fall in love, we're emotionally drawn to someone. I remember the first time I ever met Sue. I can remember what she wore. You know, I remember the long, dark hair. She had braces on her teeth at the time, and she had this infectious smile, and she, you know, as we talked, she was witty, and she was intelligent, and she enjoyed a lot of the same things that I did, and I was really emotionally drawn to her. And then we started dating, and we started growing in our relationship with one another, and eventually we married, and we have enjoyed, you know, a life together. And so emotion, you know, is a significant part of how people come into relationship. That's true on an individual basis, and it's true at an institutional basis. In other words, people will be attracted to your ministry for an emotional reason. You mean there's an organization where physicians can be a part, and we can have fellowship with one another, and we can talk about the issues, the troubling issues of bioethics and what all that means in terms of our profession? Yeah, wow, isn't that wonderful? And they come to a meeting, and they sense the fellowship, they sense the purpose, they sense a lot of things, and I say, wow, this is great. So they're emotionally, people are typically emotionally drawn to organizations in the same way that they're drawn to people. Whether or not they stay, this is true with students that come to a university or a college. They meet a professor. So, wow, what a great guy. I mean, gosh, what a great passion these people have. And they come, you know, maybe for emotional reasons. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Whether they stay is going to be predicated on what we do, you know, after they come. And real success in ministry, if you were to translate it into the context of ministry, you know, if you're evaluating from my perspective how successful a ministry is, it's measured in terms of retention. In other words, you know, engaging people at one level is one thing, retaining them is quite another. In the context of student ministry, is we're involved at Tyndall, the realities are the real success of an organization is measured in student retention. I mean, an actual number that you can look at. In other words, how many students came, how many withdrew, how many continue their involvement as with the organization as alumni in the terms of using us for continuing education and so forth. I mean, if those attrition percentages are abnormally high, if they go up into the, you know, 10, 15, 20% range, then something is seriously wrong. As you look at your membership roster at the Medical Society, if you look at, you know, how many people re-enrolled, you know, to become or to retain their membership in the society, and we see that we're having, you know, some pretty noticeable attrition, then that's communicating that something has gone awry. In the same way with, you know, church membership and so forth. And so rational, you know, in my mind, has to do with objectivity. I think probably a great illustration of talking about love and marriage. You know, my parents, my mother went to be with the Lord this year, and she went to be with the Lord about 6 days before their 70th wedding anniversary. My dad's still living; he's 90. My mother was 88, and she went to be with the Lord, and she had Alzheimer's disease for the last 10 years of her life. She didn't know any of us, and my dad would go and faithfully care for her all those years and feed her and love her. You know, one time I went to the hospital with my dad, you know, as we were coming back, I was spellbound. I really couldn't talk. I was kind of moved emotionally by what it is that I had experienced. And I looked at my dad as we were driving up the driveway and said, "Dad, I don't know how you do this." You know, he didn't say anything. He's not real talkative. You know, he just kind of, you know, rode up the driveway and didn't say a word. He gets out of the car and he puts a foot down in the driveway and another one in the car. And he looks over at me and he says, "You know," he says, "70 years ago, I stood in front of your mother in your grandmother's living room. We looked at each other," and he says, "I loved her to death. And I looked at her and I said, you know, for richer, for poor, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until death do us part." And he gets out of the car. And I'm sitting there, you know, you can imagine how I'm sitting there now. I mean, he just kind of really laid it on me, you know. And before he closed the door, he looked down into the car and he says, "I meant that." And he just closed the door and went into the house. And I'm still sitting there, you know, trying to ponder all the significance, because it was a very profound statement. And I've seen pictures of my parents before they were married. I see, you know, there's one picture that particularly comes to mind. They're on the top of a mountain, and my mother's looking up at my father like he's Sir Galahad, and my mother's looking, or my dad's looking down at my mother like she's Cinderella, you know. And they obviously are deeply in love, and you can see it in their expressions and so forth. But then they married, and, you know, they continued to be in love. I mean, but they went through a depression. They went through world wars. We lost my baby sister when she was about 3 years old. About 3 days old from spinal bifida. They went through an economic crisis. I mean, you could just kind of list these things that they'd gone through, as everybody will in relationship. But they stayed together. Why'd they stay together? Because of this rational commitment to one another, to the institution of marriage, and to all those things that are so basic. And it seems to me that when I look at my parents, you know, even at the end, you know, the emotion was still there. I mean, my dad would hold my mother, and he would feed her, and he would sit there and hold her hand and talk to her. You know, the emotion was still there. But what kept them together during the hard times, the rocky times, was this rational commitment. And really, what we need to do organizationally from a developmental standpoint is to build that kind of relationship with our organizations, because our organizations will be successful only to the degree that we build relationships of a certain quality that people... And I think the essence, in from an organizational developmental standpoint, that the essence of rationality is embodied in our mission statement. You know, people know that mission, they believe in that mission, and they have a level of confidence in our organization and its ability to be able to fulfill that mission. And so that becomes, to me, the whole paradigm that ought to characterize, you know, the developmental function. Now, as I've done all of this over the years, it became, you know, apparent to me. I teach a lot of seminars, you know, around the world, and you know, people would come to seminars and they would learn. But there was something happening that really surprised me. And I you know, initially it surprised me because I couldn't figure it out. People would leave and they'd say, you know, that was probably the most meaningful spiritual experience of my life. And I'm thinking, well, here I am talking about how to raise money and how to build infrastructure for your organization. And you're walking away saying, well, that was helpful for that purpose. But it changed my life. Because the point is that relationships, you know, I'm thinking about relationships in the context of an organization, and they're saying, but we have other relationships. We have relationships with our family. I have a relationship with my spouse. We have a relationship with our kids. We have relationships with people in our church. And what you've helped me to do is you've helped me to think about relationships. And all of a sudden, I realized that gosh... You know, I can apply these same principles into the context of every relationship that I have in life. And that has changed me. Well, I began hearing that, and, you know, it kept repeating itself, you know, seminar after seminar after seminar, and people would leave and say that was really a life-altering experience for me and so forth. And so I began thinking about the church. And I began thinking about my church. And one of the statements, Dallas Willard, I don't know if you've read any of Dallas Willard's stuff, but he's a wonderful, thought-provoking author. I'd like to say that he's a wonderful writer, but I'm not sure. He may be a wonderful writer, but he doesn't write in ways that necessarily, you know, are consistent with the way my brain works. And so I find Dallas Willard very difficult to read. But he writes stuff that I think is very, very important. His book, Renovation of the Heart, has probably had as much impact on me from a spiritual standpoint than any book I've read in the last 10 years, I believe. And I would really strongly recommend it. And actually, I picked up the book and I started reading it, and I'm thinking, gosh, I find it hard to understand this guy. But as I began to read it, I'm saying to myself, there's something here that I really need to know. And I've read through the book three times, and I'm getting ready to read through it again. It is a powerful book, and I would really strongly recommend it to you. But Dallas Willard has written a number of books, but in his book that is entitled The Spirit of the Disciplines, he's talking about spiritual disciplines, fasting and meditation and prayer and so forth. And in that book, in the spiritual disciplines, he says, or in the spirit of the disciplines, he makes this incredible statement that when I read it, I'm thinking, whoa. And it really became very motivational to me. Because it incorporates virtually everything that I've been trying to do in my profession. He said, the average church, has about as much idea how to fulfill the mandates of Scripture. Now let me just share some of the mandates of Scripture that we're all familiar with, obviously. Jesus ascended into heaven. He says, you're to be witnesses for me. Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth, he says in Matthew chapter 28, that we're to disciple and baptize people. And, you know, Paul, in talking about the church, says that, you know, we are, the church is the place where believers are equipped and trained for works of ministry. And we're to deploy those people within the church into the world to be salt and light and theoretically to make a difference, you know, in culture. He says the average church has as much idea how to fulfill the mandates of the church as the typical politician has on how to resolve the national debt of their country. I mean, the realities are we don't have a plan. We see development is about planning. Development is about change. Development is about relationships. And so as I began to, you know, pull the dots together, you know, kind of one of these little paintings that I suspect that you're all familiar with where, you know, you're painting by the numbers. But as I began to put the dots together, I'm beginning to understand that, you know, what it is that I've been talking about for the last, you know, 30 years in terms of my profession is as applicable in the church as it is, and I'm speaking in the church, small c, or maybe capital C, whatever, but I'm talking about, you know, what we're doing, you know, the developmental principles are equally as applicable. Now,
here's a question.
Yes.
My colleague had been in another session with you, and he mentioned that quote about the church having no more idea mm-hmm. how to fulfill mandates as a politician to get rid of the national
right.
debt. And my first reply to that was, well, obviously, one reason politicians never have an answer is that because the obvious solutions are always impossible. You can't do the obvious, like just be responsible in your spending. You have to have another solution rather than what's the obvious solution. So then, of course, that leads you to trying to have solutions that are hard to come up with because you should be doing the obvious solution. Does that apply also to why the church just keeps floundering and they don't use the obvious solution? Is there?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But even the obvious solution, I mean, we may look at the obvious solution in the most general of terms and say, well, the obvious solution is that people need Jesus, you know. But the realities are, how do we take the obvious solution and make it, you know, a plausible alternative to people that basically are looking for answers? What I'm trying to do is I'm hopefully trying to wed the two. Let me give you, I don't see a marker here. I thought I came in with a pen, but maybe I didn't. Because there are two little drawings that I think, you know, would be helpful. Does anybody, even if I can borrow a pen, can I borrow your, that one's green, isn't it? Pardon me? Well, that's where I thought I put it. I thought I did as well. Yeah, right. Our partner in crime back here, Ben, is gone. But yeah, would you mind going? Why don't you check for us? And does that mean, I don't mean to give you a political answer to your question.
No, that occurred to me when you said that's...
That obvious...
That's part of the problem there in that world, obviously,
right.
Because that's part of the political problem is that they have to deal with so many factors that are things like that, like... What seems to be an obvious solution is not one we can go for, so now we have to come up with other creative solutions are much more difficult to dream up or don't work, because the really the right solution or the simplest solution is just set aside. And so you kind of dig that hole for yourself, but we understand why that happens in political realms. I just wondered if, when I thought that, I thought, well, I wonder if the thing that is true of the church is often we might have a good solution, but that somehow just has to be skipped over for whatever reasons, and we go on trying to figure out some other more complicated way to do it. But since we've left behind what would have been the better way to do it, we begin kind of dig a hole for ourselves.
Right, right. And I think that may be true. Let me talk to you about, and I realize that I'm not following the notes, and so I apologize for that. I sometimes have difficulty doing that, only because it seems to me that before you can really talk about, you know, the solution, you know, a lot of the background material has to come into place, that we really know what it is that we're drawing from to come up with what I think is a very, very meaningful and a very, very practical solution to some of the problems that we confront. And I think that you will concur with that as well. So let me, I'm going to just kind of walk you through a couple of things that I think, you know, kind of basic models, if you please, or basic concepts, developmental concepts, that what I've tried to do is I've tried to take these basic concepts that we've used for years in helping organizations build infrastructure organizationally, and to draw them into the process of what it is that we really have a call of God to do, and that's really to reach people, you know, with the message of the gospel, to a point where it makes some sense for us, very, very practical sense. Because it's one thing to tell a church member, you know, you need to go out and tell people about Jesus. It's another, we know that. I mean, we know, you know, what our responsibilities are. And I think I'm going to make this statement, and perhaps it's too early. I don't know where in the context of this would be the appropriate place to make this statement. But I'm going to make it, and I just want us to kind of leave it for a little while, but I want it to be in the back of your mind. You know, years and years ago, you know, people began talking about relational evangelism. And all of a sudden, that resonated with, I think, the majority of the Christian population. You know, he says, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Because we'd been exposed to other types of evangelism. You know, you see the street evangelist out on the street, you know, pounding his Bible. And you're saying, well, I'm kind of turned off by that. That's not where I'm coming from. And then you've had the other examples that you may have not felt equally as comfortable about. You have evangelism explosion and the kind of let me walk you through the four spiritual laws, or let me take a survey to try to get your attitudes towards things. And we, you know, all kinds of little gimmicks and tricks to try to bring people to the point where we might be able to share the gospel with them, because we're serious about that. We know that we need to share the gospel of Christ, but yet none of those things really felt comfortable to us. And so when somebody wrote a book on relational evangelism, we said, no, I feel comfortable about that. And essentially what we used it for was an excuse not to do anything. You know, it kind of dealt with the guilt issues. Whew, now I don't have to do it. I'm just going to live a life and kind of hope that somebody's going to figure it out by watching me. Well, the realities are we weren't living necessarily the consistent life that really, you know, whet the appetite of the unbeliever. I want what you have. In some instances it happens, but it wasn't happening, you know, nearly as well. But I do believe in relational evangelism. But I think I've got a plan that makes it a little bit more palatable for all of us. And I think that's how I'm trying to wed a lot of these concepts together. But there's all kinds of little things that I would like to share with you real briefly. One is this. I've used this diagram for years, and you know, as simple as it is, it really communicates, I think, a lot of very significant developmental principles. You know, basically what I have is I've got a sea down here. We'll call it the sea of prospects, and you can define the sea of prospects any way you'd like to. I mean, in the context of you know, your church ministry, the sea of prospects represents the population, essentially, of the community where you serve. And basically, these individual fish, for lack of a better term, represent groups of people within the community. For instance, you have young married couples, you have professionals, you have
college-age students, and you have adolescents and so forth. So there are different groups down here, all of which need Jesus Christ, and we really long for them to come into a personal, intimate, relationship with Christ that is going to not only redeem their souls, but redeem their lives and their world, over time. Now, up here you have this building, and it's, we're going to call it the church, or we're going to call it the college, we're going to call it the medical fellowship or whatever. In other words, this is where the organizations that we represent. And it's we recognize it as being a pretty significant place. The reason that you were willing to take on the leadership of the medical association was because you could see that this organization really does provide the means, of people being able to be better equipped in the profession to do the things that we need to be doing, not only as professionals, but as Christians, and trying to marry those two is really pretty important to us. You look at the church as being the place where this is where God is really doing some things. We can equip people, we can train people, and we really have the potential of really impacting the culture of the community. In the same way with a college, can you imagine that if the seminary, if everybody that left seminary left with not only the tools that they need in order to be effective in terms of their professional capacities of exegeting and communicating and doing the things that we do, but yet they left with an incredible passion and a plan to really reach their world for Christ. Boy, what a difference we could make. And so, this in the context of the greater message of really reaching our world, that, this house represents the church, small C or capital C or however we want to do that. But basically, this is the means through which God has designed, to really reach the world. Now, it has a front door and it has a front porch. And the analogy is going to break down a little bit, because I'm not talking about people coming to faith in Christ when I talk about some of these actions, but I am talking about something that I think we can understand. But basically, there are three steps here in the process that bring people into a relationship with an organization. Let's use an organizational illustration, and then we'll come back and try to make other applications. The first thing is what I call the entry-level opportunity. And the entry-level opportunity is anything that we do to basically bring people to the front porch. How do we bring people out of the sea of prospects to the front porch? If you were trying to recruit doctors to become members of the medical fellowship, how do we bring them to a point where we can expose them essentially to our work and what it is that we do? Well, you could say, we have, regional, breakfast. We have, a national conference. We have all kinds of things that we do that basically expose people to what it is our ministry is all about. In the case of Pavel's ministry in Poland, we do things in the community. We have a soup kitchen. We have, special holiday celebrations where we really want to, allow and provide the community the opportunity of being able to celebrate. One example that I'm thinking about, I have a friend in the Czech Republic in Ostrava. His name is Pavel, P-A-V-E-L, and so there's a little bit of combination there. But Pavel, their church, has a couple of really huge events in Ostrava, basically bringing people together, and they have a big Christmas celebration and a candle lighting service and so forth, and it's sponsored by the little evangelical church. Well, what happens is all these little people in the community representing all these little groups in the community basically come to the event, and essentially what we're doing, practically speaking, is we're opening the door and we're allowing them to get a glimpse of who it is we are. Now remember, if you're standing on the front porch of anything, you don't get the big picture. You just basically get a little glimpse. You have a physician who's really godly, who's doing the delivery of that particular regional activity. And, you don't understand the full dimensions of what it is that the medical society is doing. You don't understand that. But what you do see is you say, well, gosh, that's pretty good. Isn't this incredible? And you get a perspective. Imagine standing at your front door. Just go there sometime and open the door and just don't move. Just stand there. And then try to describe the house, or go to somebody else's front door or whatever, but try to describe the house from the perspective of the front porch. I mean, you're not going to see the whole house. You're not going to see all the back rooms and all the, you know, some of the other fine features of the house, but you're going to get an idea. You're going to see the foyer. You may see the living room or the dining room or whatever the case might be. Well, one of the key things about development, and this is a concept. Now, this is the concept that I really wanted to emphasize, is that there need to be these kinds of what I call front door opportunities, for lack of a better term. If we're going to really reach people for Christ in your town, then we've got to think through what can be some of the front door opportunities that we might be able to create. I'll explain some of those in just a few moments. Well, then the next step in the process is obviously if somebody comes to the front door and you'd like them to come into the house, what would you say? Well, come on in. Come on in. And I call that the bridge. The bridge. And the bridge, think of the bridge as an invitation. And when we get an invitation, will you come in? We're basically being asked to make a yes or a no answer. You know, that's what we want people to say. Well, yes, I'd like to come in. And we'd prefer that they'd say yes as opposed to no. But that's a rational decision. You see, it may have been emotion that brought you to, I mean, you might have just come with your buddy, you know, to the medical meeting. But the invitation is extended, well, we'd like you to come in. Well, that's a rational decision. You may have made an emotional decision here, but this is going to be a choice. Yes, I'd like to learn more about this organization and so forth. So the result is conversion. And I mean conversion not necessarily, you know, that somebody responded in faith to Jesus, but I am saying that let's say that we brought 50 people to the front porch and 25 came in, then we've had a 50% conversion rate. That's what I'm talking about here when I talk about conversion. Is that 50% of the people that came to the front porch came, you know, actually walked into the house. Okay? So kind of keep that thought in the back of your mind. I'd like to talk a little bit about bridging and two assumptions. There are two assumptions that we make in ministry, and both of these assumptions are wrong. And so it's really important that we understand this. There are two assumptions that we make in ministry, both of which are wrong. The first assumption that we make is that when we say something, everybody gets it. Okay? So we bring people to the front porch and we make statements, you know, about our organization. We make statements about, you know, Christ and the redemptive work that he can accomplish in the lives of people and so forth. And we make statements to that effect. And the assumption is that, you know, everybody gets it. Oh, well, gosh, I never heard that before. That's great information. And boy, I'm going to go back and really kind of work on that. We can't assume that everybody got it. And I always tell people that if you really believe that, you've never had a teenager live in your house. And for those of us that have, you know, raised families, you know, in the context of, you know, raising kids, they do something really stupid. And you look at them and you say, well, you shouldn't have done that. If I told you once, I probably told you 100 times that you shouldn't do that. And they just kind of look at you and say, well, gee, I never heard that before. And so you can't assume that they just, you know, heard it. And the other assumption that you can't make, that we always make, is that people are going to expend the energy to try to figure out how to deal with information. In other words, oh, yeah, well, I could do this, 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 this. You know, that, oh, yeah, that would be wonderful. You know, in relationship to the organization. Well, I could pray for the organization. I could become a member of the organization. I could be actively involved at the regional level in the organization. I could do this in the organization. I could get their newsletter. You know, all those things. I could do all of that. Nobody's going to take that energy. Because it involves energy. It's the expansion of energy. And the realities are this is only one of the several things, you know, several front porches essentially we've been brought to. And we've developed an incredible amount of sales resistance in our society because, you know, we turn on the radio, we get lots of advertisements. We turn on the TV, we get lots of commercials. We turn, you know, we drive down the highway and there are lots of billboards. And the realities are, you know, everybody's talking about something. And basically, we're oblivious to most of it. We don't take the energy because it does require the expenditure of energy to try to act upon information when you get it. So, that's where bridges come in. And this is pretty important, I think, to the ongoing. There is a point here, a focal point, where we're going to make a pretty significant turn in the road here. But to me, that's a very, very critical point, is to understand bridges. So let me give you some examples. Let's say that you know, Pavel, you know, has a Christmas candle lighting service in Poland, you know, and we're inviting the community because we really are thrilled, you know, to be able to, you know, to remember this very important time, you know, when God sent his son into the world. And so it's a wonderful program and everybody comes and we're all just kind of, you know, goosebumpy, you know, about, you know, this celebration. We really feel good about it and so forth. And so Pavel comes and says, you know, it's really such a joy for our church to be able to do this. And thanks so much for coming. And for those of you that have come that said, well, boy, I'd like to, you know, to learn more about what it is that, you know, the coming of Christ really means and ought to mean in terms of my life, we'd like to just share with you five or six ways that you could, continue, you know, this thought process that perhaps has begun this evening. Maybe you'd like to receive a little newsletter that we send out via email, something that kind of talks about, you know, the relevance of Christ coming to the issues that impact our community. And if you'd like to get that newsletter, we'd love to send it to you. It doesn't cost anything. There are some other things that we're doing where we have some critical issues that we've identified in our community that we're really seeking, you know, by God's grace to address. And, you know, all of them we believe the relevance of Christ is pertinent to. And if you'd like to, you know, be a part of some small groups that are going to discuss those issues, we'd love to have you consider that. We'd love to have you be a part of that. And then, you know, maybe two or three others. But the point is, what you're seeking to do is you're seeking people to say yes. Now, in giving bridges, and I've really gone through something that I would typically take, you know, 20 minutes or a half an hour to explain in greater detail. But in giving bridges, there's a couple of things to remember. Always provide a multiplicity of bridges. See, you want people to say yes. So always provide a multiplicity of bridges. You know, let me share with you five. And the way that I like to express bridges is the way that I just did. And let me share with you five or six ways that you could be a meaningful part of the medical association, or the medical association could be a meaningful part of your life. And here are some things that you might do. We have a trial membership or something that, we have some courses that you could take, or this, that, or the other thing. So always provide a multiplicity of bridges. And remember that between the front porch and the foyer, there's a threshold. You know, that little, you know, keep the threshold low. In other words, don't make it so challenging to people to have to get in that they're going to need a pole vault to get over the threshold. In other words, what we do is we want people in the foyer and in the family room because that's where relationships are built. You know, it's pretty hard to build a relationship with somebody when you're standing in the foyer and they're standing on the front porch. What you really want to do is you want to bring them in, sit down, and let's have a cup of coffee together, and let's begin this process of really building a relationship. So there is the point that I want to make, at least at this point, is to have us really understand, and that is that there are, you know, reasonable steps that you know, take place if you were to, you know, basically dissect the relationship. You know, that's good physicians dissect things. And if you were to dissect the relationship, you would see that there are things that have that contributed, you know, to the establishment of that relationship. And so what I try to do in my work is to try to look at the end and see what it is that happened, you know, that brought people to the point where they have this satisfying, fulfilling relationship. Now, so that's really important. That's a basic concept that becomes kind of key to what I believe we need to do in order to really impact culture. There's another illustration that I use that has been really helpful to people that I think makes an important point, especially, and we're going to build on this concept as well. This is what I call, I mean, I don't even know what I call it. It's kind of the process of development or you know, relationship building. But I want you to think here of this describes my relationship, you know, to coming to a point of marrying Sue, for example. And these are decisions that were made along the way. And each of these decisions, and this would be true, I think, in how relationships build. I think even in response to the salvation message of Christ. You know, there's a part of us that kind of hope that the depraved person is going to kind of march right through the front door of the church and get saved and then, you know, is going to stay in the church and be deployed out as salt and light. We kind of have this idea that they're just going to come, and wouldn't it be nice if that were the case? But it doesn't work quite that way, does it? That basically, you know, what it is that brought you to faith in Jesus Christ, what it is that brought me to faith in Christ, was a whole series of things that if you were to look back, you can see, well, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened, and all of a sudden I just realized that I really needed what it is that Christ had to offer. Well, if the analogy of falling in love is in fact a good analogy, let me show you how it would play out. See, I asked Sue to take me, I asked her to go out to a movie and dinner. So we went out for a movie and dinner. Now, this was just two single people, you know, let's go out and go to a movie and have dinner. Pretty, you know, she could have said no if I were, you know, ugly and honorary and, you know, and any number of reasons why she might have said no. She could have said no, and then there never would have been a relationship. But she was curious enough, and we kind of, you know, hit it off in that first meeting where we met each other. And she said, yeah, let's do that. And so we did. Well, then I asked her again, you know, maybe a week later. I says, well, let's do that again. Let's go to a show or something like that. Now, you know, for her to say yes the second time would mean that she's really kind of making a different kind of a yes, because she's essentially saying, yeah, this guy I had a good time with, you know, and I wouldn't mind pursuing the relationship. Or she might say, I think he may have some intentions in terms of this relationship, and I don't really want to go there, okay? But she said yes again. Well, then there were a whole lot of other little things, but there came a point in time where I said, well, I'd like you to meet some of my friends. Well, now that's starting to get a little bit more serious, because she's probably smart enough to realize that if I'm taking her to see her friends or my friends, that basically I'm trying to get, you know, I'm kind of up for review, you know, and they're going to kind of analyze whether or not, you know, this is a good person for Jerry. And then I said, well, why don't we go to my, you know, meet my parents? Well, my gracious, I mean, that is a major commitment. And then finally, you know, I brought it to a place and point in time where I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And I knew she was going to say yes. It wasn't like this was rocket science. I mean, I knew she was going to say yes. And so she said yes, and then she said yes again. You know, I do, in front of a pastor and in several hundred people. And we began a new relationship. And the point that I want to make here, and there's a lot of things that happen after this, which we can talk about, you know, if we had, you know, several hours together, we could continue to talk about. But the point that I want to make, at least at this point, is that people, you know, being brought to a point of decision, there are a lot of things that precede it. And it's understanding that and planning that and basically thinking of that more strategically that is going to determine our ability to be able to impact lives, to bringing people to a point of decision. So that becomes an important precursor to what it is that we need to talk about. Now, there are some others, and I'm going to just list them here. I hope you don't give up on me, because I can assure you that if you just hang in for another, you know, hour or so, all of this stuff is going to start merging together in something that's very, very significant. But there are some other models that I want to share with you when we come back from our coffee break. One is kind of a general concept of cultivation. How do you cultivate a relationship strategically? It's real simple. And I think when you see it, you say, yeah, whoa, wow, I could do that. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to talk about a kind of a strategic planning model. And that sounds a whole lot worse than it is in terms of. But the point is that I think that there is a model for planning that we might want to take a look at. And then I want to talk to you about an organizational backdrop. In other words, how do you do this organizationally? How do we organize ourselves to get these things done? I think when we work through these next three steps, then we're going to be at the point of saying, okay, how do we really impact culture? How can we put together a plan within our ministry, be it your church, your school, or your association, to really take things to the next level? Because the ultimate level, I mean, if you were to come back to your ministry, and this is a good question, and maybe it's a good question to leave and go to the break with. One of the things that I speak to a lot of church groups, you know, and pastors' conferences and denominational things about these topics that are so important to me. And one of the questions that I like to ask them, I says, imagine, you know, the year is 2015. It's 10 years from now. And God has, you know, used our Medical Association in incredible ways over the last 10 years. And, you know, the college and the seminary is just, you know, 15 years or 10 years from now. I mean, you know, everything that we've put in place that we've been hearing about this morning has come to realization. And, you know, the, you know, imagine 10 years from now. Remember, you know, let's, you know, we come back, you know, to the forum 10 years from now, and Pavel comes in and says, "Let me tell you what's happening in Poland." And everything that we could have possibly have dreamt, you know, came to reality. What would it look like? What would be different? How would your community be different if you were totally successful in fulfilling the vision that God has given to you? How would the world be different if you were totally successful in fulfilling what it is that God's called you to do as a seminary? How would the medical profession and the United Kingdom look like? What would it look like if 5,000 doctors, I mean, can you stop? I mean, all of us, but can you imagine 5,000 physicians with an agenda, how that might reflect itself within the context of the culture of the United Kingdom if the mission of the medical association was realized to its fullest potential? What would it look like? Now, I talk to many churches that have been in existence for 10 and 20 and 30 and 50 and 100 years. And quite frankly, if a tornado or a bomb or whatever took them off the scene, most of the people in the community wouldn't even know. I mean, if your seminary were to disappear, would it make a difference? If your society were to disappear, would anything change? I mean, really? Would anything really change? I had to answer that question myself because I was writing this book and I looked at my wife one day and, you know, I said, "Honey," I says, "I've come to the conclusion that if I were to die tomorrow, nobody in this community, the neighborhood where I live, would really care. In fact, most of the people in my neighborhood would not even know who it was. Jerry Twombly just died. Well, who's Jerry Twombly?" "Well, he's the guy that lives in the brick house. You know, he runs, and, you know, he kind of waves. Oh, he died. Oh, that's too bad." I mean, is that what God would have us? I mean, the realities are, is the fingerprint, you know, it, when we die and when our ministries, you know, 15 years from now, is the fingerprint of God's involvement through our ministry going to be seen everywhere we've been? And that's the issue that I think we need to address. I mean, that's the concept that we really need to understand. But the realities are, it's not going to happen apart from a plan. And that's what I really believe. I mean, I'm not suggesting that God can't do a lot of things, but I'm thinking that, you know, if we were just to get a little bit better organized and, you know, really articulate what that vision might look like, because I would love for you to do that. I would like you to go home and to say, this is what the world's going to look like 10 years from now, because this is what it is that we're, because of our ministry being there. I would like to see you do that with your church, is to say, 10 years from now, this is what it is, and get down with a group of people among them, you know, get with a bunch of physicians and say, what do we want the, you know, the United Kingdom to look like because we're here? Because are we just the repository for somebody's dues? You know, somebody that can help us keep an organization in existence by providing, or do we have a mission that we are dead set on focusing on, like a laser beam, you know, and that everything that we're doing now is a part of something that is really going to get us to where it is that we want to go, because society should be different because there are 5,000 godly men that are in the medical profession in the United Kingdom. Something should change. That's palatable. Let's go get a cup of coffee. Okay, the fellowship is, I was saying goodbye to some very, very dear friends. It's the forum is such a wonderful place. And since I've been coming here, this is my third year. A lot of the people that have been here in the past, you know, continue to come back, and so the friendships are growing deep and very, very meaningful. And my two friends from Poland, who I just dearly love, just left, and I'm really rather emotional about it. Actually, they're such good friends. So anyway, let's work through some of these other, I call them models, for lack of a better term, And just keep in mind, you know, the principles, because there are some significant principles here that I think you'll find to be incredibly helpful, in the application of ministry, for the respective ministries that are represented here. Here's an individual with whom we'd like to build a relationship. This is going to be real simple, but I think there are some things that are, from a cultivation standpoint, that are really important to remember. This is a doctor. This is a church member. This is a student or a constituent, within your organization, somebody that you're seeking to build a relationship. Relationships, there are two things that you need to know about this individual that's going to determine how impactful your ministry is going to be with them. One has to do with what I call vestiture, and what I simply mean by vestiture is this an individual who has invested something in your ministry? In other words, have they given of their time? Have they given of their resources? Have they devoted something of significance to what it is that you do, contributed something of significance to what it is that you do that would cause you to say, well, they have invested or they're vested in our ministry? There are going to be some, obviously, that have done that. They're vested, and there are some that have not invested anything. In other words, they may know about you, But basically their level of involvement is more from a distance rather than actively being involved. I suspect there are more than 5,000 Christian physicians or medical people, within the context of the United Kingdom. Despite the fact that that's a very impressive number, it probably doesn't represent the total. So there are some vested prospects out there, for lack of a better term. Then this has to do with what I call cultivation. And cultivation, let's say, for the sake of illustration, there are four levels, and we'll represent them by a letter, that there are some people within your organization that are extremely well-cultivated. We'll call them A's, and there are some that are, pretty well-cultivated, and if you were to look at them, you'd say, oh, yeah, they're really kind of into what it is that we're doing, but you wouldn't put them in the same category as your A's. Somehow, there's something in your mind that says, no, they're not quite there yet, but they're pretty well on their way. Then there might be others that you would say, well, they're C's. They're kind of. I mean, at least they know who it is we are. But you wouldn't put them into the B category or the A category. And then there's some that people have identified, well, here's somebody that really, is someone that you need to build a relationship with. But there's absolutely no connection whatsoever. In other words, in the context of, Pavel's ministry and the community where he's at, there are people that you really would like to target to build a relationship with because you realize that if they were to come to know Christ and to take seriously the claims of Christ on their life, that it really could be a pivotal point in really turning a community around in the direction, perhaps that, God could really work. So there are what I call A, B, C, D prospects. Well, it's really kind of interesting, isn't it, how the combination of these things, becomes a bit of a predictability barometer. In other words, if you knew that half the people that you're working with are non-vested D's, then you could probably predict, in terms of ministry impact, that you're going to have a pretty marginal impact on them. Because, for crying out loud, they don't know you and they've never invested anything with you, then the realities are, if you were to present anything to them in terms of opportunity, they're probably going to say no. In other words, would you like to do this? No. Would you like to give money? No. Would you like to respond to Jesus? No. And it's not because necessarily they're indifferent or they don't have a need. It's because, there's been no cultivation of the relationship. We've come up with an acronym over the years called AID, A-I-D, and it's kind of a little helpful acronym because it kind of objectifies what typically is perceived as being subjective. I mean, when you look at a donor and you say, well, I think they're a C, that's kind of a subjective judgment. You haven't built that on any kind of a rational framework. So, what would it look like? So let's try to be a little bit objective about it. A stands for attendance. I stands for involvement, and D stands for donation. And you may want to just put in parentheses, commitment or sacrifice here. Because essentially what we're suggesting is that people that make a donation, whether that be of their time or whatever, I mean, you've made a significant donation to the society by virtue of the fact that you're willing to assume the role of the general secretary at no cost over a period of 2 years. I mean, that's a significant commitment. That goes beyond money, but it's obviously still a commitment, so it would qualify here in this category. If somebody has done all three, they equal an A. If they've done two of the three, they equal a B. If they've done one of the three, they equal a C. If they've done none of the three, they equal a D. And so basically, if you're looking at your database, or in that database, see, I think, you know, in the case of developing a church ministry in a village in Poland, eventually, you know, there comes a point in time where, you know, you begin thinking about, you know, people, you know, that you really would like to build a relationship with in the hopes that many of them would come to know Jesus as their Savior. And let's say that all of them are non-vested D's. And so you might want to put their name in a database, and you know, I know that that sounds really unspiritual and very technical, but the reality is that it becomes the basis of a prayer list, doesn't it, in many respects? We're going to start praying for these people. And you get the whole congregation, and the whole congregation is 20, all right? But basically, you've got your hit list, for lack of a better term. Here are some people that we really want to build a relationship with, because strategically, you know, and I realize the... there's this thin realm, you know, and I struggle with this a little bit between being strategic and allowing the Spirit of God to move. But I think, you know, the realities are that God, you know, really expects us to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. In other words, you know, God, Jesus, you know, commended the faithful steward, you know, and basically condemned the one who buried his talent. Some of them had been shrewd in their investments, and they were applauded, they were commended by God and rewarded by God for what it is that they've done. And so I think, you know, in the Christian world, you know, we walk this tightrope between, you know, whether or not we're going to, you know, really depend totally upon the Spirit of God and just kind of let it all happen, or if we're going to be a little shrewd in terms of strategy and really focusing. And I think, you know, the latter is probably, from my perspective, to be commended. Well, if you were to look at predictability patterns just in relationship to this, by the way, there's about a 0% likelihood that a D prospect is going to respond affirmatively to any message that you have. There's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect would, a 60% likelihood that a B prospect would, and a 90% likelihood that an A prospect would. And so the point is, obviously, if you're like me, who, you know, don't necessarily handle rejection real well, what I had to learn intuitively in my profession, what I knew intuitively in my profession, you know, I had to bring to some level of objectivity to kind of make sure that I was, you know, creating an environment that would really allow for success. But intuitively, I knew these people weren't going to say yes to an invitation to participate. I mean, I just knew that. So I even bothered to ask them in the first place, you know. So I'd spent a lot of time down here trying to move D's to C's and C's to B's and so forth. I didn't mind. I don't mind these odds. 60% is still better than 50%, you know. So I figure that I still, the likelihood is still in my favor if, in fact, I can craft the invitation right, that they're going to respond affirmatively. And so basically, you know, I can live with this scenario. So the point being, you know, to make a long story, to bring a long illustration to a point of a focal point, is that, you know, think about these words. You know, how can we bring people? How can we bring them to a point where they could attend something? Because the moment somebody attends something, they cross the threshold to attend whatever it is that you've invited them to attend, the likelihood of their ongoing development, you know, has exponentially increased by 30%. If they choose to become involved, which now forces us, and I can't emphasize how important what it is that I'm saying is, and I'm sure you're grasping it in terms of developmental significance, but, you know, we really need to think. I think, you know, you ought to sit down and say, you know, try to imagine ways in which you can involve people. It's so important from so many different directions. I could spend hours talking about how important involvement is, but involvement, you know, provides opportunity for people to take ownership in what it is you're doing. And the realities are that the enduring impact of your organization is going to be predicated to a significant degree to the degree that you can start sharing the burden. You see, as long as the burden is upon you to impact your community, and nobody shares that burden, nobody's bought into your vision for really impacting a community for Christ, then eventually your impact is going to be marginalized at best. So what we need to do is we need to share the burden. You know, some other physicians, you know, need to take on the responsibilities for doing things related to the mission of the organization in their respective regions. And we need to sit down and try to figure out ways to engage them. I'm a strong believer in decentralized development, and especially in an organization like yours, where if, in fact, you want to reach Eastern Europe, and if you really want to have, you know, students from Eastern Europe come to your seminar, then the realities are we need to have a presence in Eastern Europe, and I mean in every country in Eastern Europe, and we need to have somebody on the ground in Eastern Europe who basically is helping us to identify, and that could be easily a volunteer, obviously, and it probably must be a volunteer, but it needs to be a part of a strategic plan. Otherwise, we kind of hope that Eastern Europeans might come, and we hope that people that we do have linkage with in Eastern Europe are going to tell the message of Tendill Seminary and really, you know, oh, well, gee, that's where I want to go. But the realities are, you know, hoping and the realities of what hoping generates, you know, don't always match up. And so it does require some level of strategization. That's what we're trying to do with UCCF, is trying to work towards a point where development is being done, you know, in the university towns where the UCCF has a presence. I mean, they have a presence in Nottingham, a very significant presence in Nottingham. But we haven't taken advantage of that from a developmental standpoint to really impact the greater vision to which the organization is committed. So
that's part of the reason we would come to something like this.
Uh-huh.
So that we would generate the interest of someone in another country.
Right.
And they would sense be a person in that country that because they know of us, they would be there saying to people, well, there's the school that can meet the need.
Right. But this meeting is not sufficient to do
right.
that. But it could start if it's the beginning of a process, then that's very valuable. If it's perceived as being an end all, then the realities are nothing's going to happen. And so too often, you know, we think, you know, too compartmentalized. You know, we've got to think more linearly, at least in terms of the, you know, the long term goal and where it is we're going. But unless that's even clearly understood in our mind as to what the infrastructure would look like in a country. Then essentially what it is that happens here is marginalized. In other words, if in fact our goal is to have this kind of an presence in a country, which means that we're going to, certain things are going to, guaranteed to be happened, then all of a sudden what it is that happens here takes on a new dimension because it's part of the journey that's taking us to an ultimate goal. So that's a wonderful point. Now, let's talk about strategic planning in a real general sense. Essentially, I spent a whole session yesterday in our network talking about strategic planning, and I didn't even begin to touch on it because typically, you know, we will do entire 2 and 3 day workshops just on strategic planning for organizations. But let me just kind of give you some of the key points here, because at least down to here, because it does become a part of the plan that I would like to see, you know, churches and organizations implement, you know, that would lead to hopefully transformation of culture. But there are these 5 initial steps. One begins with profiling the ideal as it relates to various aspects of what it is that you feel God has called you to do. I talked to you just before we left about profiling, you know, what the United Kingdom would look like, you know, 15 or 10 years from now, in the year 2015, what, you know, Tendill Theological Seminary would look like, and what the world would look like as a result of the successful ministry of Tendill Seminary, or what your community in Poland would look like if you were totally successful. Well, that process is essentially profiling, and essentially what we're trying to do is we're saying, okay, this is what our ministry would look like, but every aspect of what it is we do needs to be profiled. In other words, I sat down with my pastor not too long ago in relationship to a group of people. Now we're moving in a little bit to where it is that I want to take you today. But I was talking to my pastor not too long ago about a group of people that I had placed myself in. And this is an aside, but it's an important aside, so don't miss this. I don't want you to pass it off, because it is. We are starting to get into some of the issues that are included in the notes. But if you are to achieve, let's dream again, you know, that this, you know, this is what our church is going to, you know, this is what the community is going to look like in 2015. This is what the seminar is going to look like in 2015. And the world is going to look like as a result of the seminary's ministry. This is what United Kingdom is going to look like in 2015, you know, because of the incredible impact that the medical society has had upon, you know, the attitudes of people that live, you know, in the United Kingdom. All right, now here's the next question that you need to ask. What groups of people, practically speaking, okay, would be critical to that success? Okay, now that's a very, very important point. In other words, if I wanted to reach my community for Christ, you know, what groups of people, you know, would be critical to my success? Well, you could kind of all kinds of groups, couldn't you? I mean, you could say, well, gee, you know, professional people, business people, you know, obviously. I mean, you know, every person needs Jesus. But there is a sense in which, you know, certain groups will have, because of their place in society or whatever, you know, tend to be the focal point that others look at, you know. In other words, physicians, I'm so excited about what it is that you do. I hope that my level of enthusiasm for your ministry shines through a bit, because, you know, in many communities, you know, the physicians, the doctors, the professionals are the people in the community that the people in the community look to. I mean, they look to them for, you know, obviously if you get an ailment, you're going to go to, you know, to the doctor. Chris is going to help us, you know, deal with that. But they look to you for other directions. And so, you know, that's a critical group. And I think if I could build a case, you know, given amount of time and you know, to say, you know, let's realize that the realities are we could be the leaders in literally launching, you know, a revival in the United Kingdom. Because people look to us for leadership, and it's wrong for us not to assume the role that people, you know, in terms as Christians, to really make impact in the community much beyond our profession, but in conjunction. And some of the things that you're obviously concerned about, how do we, you know, do the things that we're doing? Okay, so critical groups are important. That's the point that I want to make. So I think part of the process of transforming culture is trying to identify the people that could be significantly, that play a significant role in us being able to do that. Now, I was talking about my pastor because I want to talk about profiling a little bit. One of the things, because I have this real passion for my church where I worship, and one of the things that, you know, I did one day, I was sitting in church and I'm thinking, you know, what group of people am I, do I most closely relate to? See, I'm a part of any number of groups. I'm a businessman, I'm a senior citizen, I'm a grandfather, I'm a father. I mean, you know, think of all the groups, you know, because there are lots of groups in churches, there are lots of groups everywhere. And so there's any number of groups that you might fit into. But there's probably one group that you really kind of more closely relate to than others. Well, I was thinking about this actually one Sunday morning in church, and then there was a coffee break, and we all got up and, you know, like we did out here, and we gathered coffee, and we're starting to talk. I mean, what I'm doing is and you were doing the same thing this morning, but you found some people that you knew, and you're just sipping coffee and talking with one another. Well, as I'm doing that on a Sunday morning, I'm struck by the fact, who am I talking to? Who am I talking to? And I kind of looked at the guys that I was talking to, and you know what they were? They were all men that were my age, 60 years old and above. They were all business people that owned their own business, and they were all still working. I mean, they, you know, basically they hadn't retired, and they really didn't have any desire to retire. At least they weren't showing that inclination. So I came back into church, and I began to ask myself the question. I wrote down on the top of a piece of paper, I wrote down working male seniors. Okay, we're senior citizens, we're working, and we're men, all right? And then as I'm sitting around in church, and my pastor thought I was taking notes, he was really impressed, you know. I'm sitting down writing names, I'm looking around the congregation. I said, well, here's a working male senior, here's a working male senior. And I worship in a fairly large church, but I came up with a list of about 60.
Okay, so these are all working male seniors. And I kind of slid it into my Bible, all right? Now, this is where we're starting to make a transition here. So this is what we came to talk about, and that's transforming culture. But all this other stuff, as you'll see, was very, very important to, you know, being able to have a meaningful discussion on how effectively that could happen within the context of our organizations. I put this in my Bible. I went to my pastor. And we were actually having coffee. It was not part of an agenda that I had. We were just having, you know, coffee together, which is something that we do on a reasonably regular basis. And we're sitting there talking. And it occurred to me that I had this list. And I think, oh, gee, I kind of reached into my Bible. Here's the list. I passed it to my pastor. I said, look at that list of people. And he's kind of looking at the list of people. I mean, that's all I told him. I look at the list of people. He's looking at the list of people. He says, man, that's a pretty significant list. He says, how did you ever happen to come up with that list? And I says, well, you know, I was kind of thinking about these things, and I told him the process. And he says, well, that's great. And then I asked him the question, and this is the point that I want to make. I asked him the question, if our ministry was totally successful in impacting the lives of these men, these are men in the church, what would they look like if we'd had that kind of impact? And so that's the profile question. And he kind of leaned back in his chair, and he says, well, that's kind of an interesting question. And then he just began to talk. He says, well, these guys would really, you know, be responsible and men of integrity. He says, you know, I know a lot of guys, and I've been in ministry for many, many years, and I see a lot of guys that build themselves up to a point where they have an incredible platform to really impact their worlds, and then they do something really crazy. You know, they have an affair, or they sin, and they lose their reputation, and hence the impact that they could have. He says, I just really long to see these guys know and love God and hold themselves accountable to one another and so forth. And he just kind of went on that topic, and I'm kind of writing it down. Okay, I'm just kind of jotting that down. Okay. And then he says, well, you know, these guys need to be mentors because, you know, we've got, you know, these guys in our church, but you know something, there are probably 60 guys right underneath them in our church that are in the same profession, you know. And we've had, there were some physicians, you know, in my group of 60, you know, working male seniors. Well, there's some young physicians in our church, you know, young guys, you know, who, you know, love the Lord, and they're just coming up in the profession. You know, my pastor looked at me and he says, you know, Jerry, you've made every mistake known to man, and that's true, you know, in the context of entrepreneurial activity in which I've been involved. And he says, you know, there's some young guys going up our church that have that same entrepreneurial spirit and so forth, and they just need somebody to kind of guide them through some of these waters, these rough waters that they go through, because there will, you know, the very nature of entrepreneurialism, you know, indicates that you're probably going to, you know, fail 40% of the time, and you kind of like it to be that way, or 30% of the time, but there's still going to be some failures. But, you know, basically what makes an entrepreneur is they just kind of walk through those because they have an agenda that, you know, exceeds that. And so he made some statements, and that's the point that I want to make. But profiling is the beginning of the planning process, okay? Then you go through assessment, where basically you look at the profile against reality. And you say, you give it a grade. Let's say, well, this is A, B, C, or D. You know, C is where we don't even closely relate to that. In other words, if this is the ideal, we've got a long way to go, okay? So we give it a grade. How do we assess reality against the ideal? Thirdly, we prioritize. Or no, we quantify. Now, for instance, at Tyndale, you know, in an ideal world, we've got a network of people in Eastern European countries who are working, you know, who understand our mission, who come back to the campus on a regular basis. I mean, you could, you know, think, I mean, this is the ideal. They come back on a regular basis. They have interactions with college presidents of Bible schools and Bible institutes in their country, you know, and you just kind of go on and on and on. So this is the profile. If we had that, that would be great. Okay, somebody in every country in Eastern Europe and all the republics of the former Soviet Union, or whatever the case might be. That's the ideal. All right, let's assess. How are we doing? A, B, C, or D? And you're saying, you know, Craig's saying, well, gosh, Jerry, we're at D. You know,
Why are you a D? Because none of those things exist. So you start numbering them. Okay, well, we don't have somebody in every country. We don't even know, all the Bible colleges, Bible institutes that exist in those countries. We know some of them, but we don't maybe know all of them. We never have people come back to the campus and kind of sit in on courses and get to know the faculty and so forth. And we don't do this, that, and the other thing. Okay, so now we've quantified essentially deficiencies. All right, the next step is prioritization. Of all the deficiencies that you've listed, which are the most mission critical? We need somebody, somebody that would basically lock arms with us and say, I want to be a part of what it is that God's doing there. So maybe that's the first step. We just got to find somebody. And I'm sure on a regionalization basis, if you were to divide the, and you probably have done this already, there are some wonderful tools that are available, for organizations like yours. Microsoft has a wonderful little software package called MapPoint. And for organizations like yours that have an international presence, you can put your whole database into MapPoint, and then you basically can print out a map that will actually show with dots and so forth where your pockets of influence are. So if you don't have a focused regional activity, then basically it shows you where you ought to do it. I mean, it becomes very, very obvious to you, well, we need to do it here in Manchester, we need to do it here in Birmingham, we need to do it here in Southampton, or whatever the case might be. And so now we got to find, put organizational infrastructure together that's going to help us to achieve the vision for what it is that we want to be. And then essentially you can plan. Okay, now that we have a prioritized list of objectives, now we can really put a plan together. And then you need to create organization. How are we going to organize ourselves? And that's where I want to go next, is talking a little bit about organization. How do we organize ourselves to get the work done? And then, we need to implement the plan, and then we need to, essentially regularly evaluate it in terms of its, how well it's doing. But the point that I want to bring together is that this process, of planning needs to occur at every level. We need to kind of go through this. Because just like there were working male seniors in our church, there are college-age kids, and there are, middle school students, and there are elementary, there are parents of, elementary school kids, and there are senior citizens that are retired, there are wives of these working male seniors, so they all represent groups. And what I've discovered in development is that it's far easier to strategize around groups. In other words, it's hard to think about 2 million people on a database, like Habitat for Humanity has. But you know what? Those 2 million people fall into some pretty distinctive groups. And so if I were in the situation of Habitat for Humanity, which we have been, and we've worked with them in helping them to do this, basically we looked at their list, and then we began to analyze it. What groups do these particular, individuals fit into? I mean, if you're getting gifts of $10,000 or more on an annual basis from individuals, then they at least represent mega donors, larger contributors. If you're getting gifts between $1,000 and $10,000, they may make up major donors. If you're getting gifts from a lot of corporations and businesses, then you have, corporate groups and so forth. And so, that's where it starts. And then you start working into the profiling. Well, if this group was perfect, what would they know about us? If we were to kind of create the perfect ideal of the perfect donor, what would they look like? And so now we're beginning to define, to give it some kind of body or shape. And it's then we can start becoming objective, because until you get down to the objective functions, then development is really just ethereal. It's kind of, we kind of hope it works, but the realities are it probably won't. Okay? Now, organization. We have an organizational chart that looks like this. Now, this is, it's a circle organizational chart, and there's nothing terribly magical about a circle organizational chart. I like it because it helps me to visualize things a little bit more clearly than the typical organizational chart that kind of looks like this, and you all have seen, these and so forth. And that to me is a little too ambiguous. This really helps me to relate, in terms that I can not only clearly visually understand, but it helps me to see things that otherwise I might miss. Now, some general rules that drive organizational concepts. There are two that I think are really important to remember. Never try to accomplish more than 5 objectives in conjunction with any initiative. In other words, let's say that you're going to be working with, you've identified, countries. Let's say in Craig's instance, he's identified, 6 countries that they'd like to work in this year. And so my challenge would be to you is to say, okay, let's figure out 5 things we could happen, this year that would move us closer to what it is, the ideal picture of what it is we want to happen in all these countries, throughout Eastern Europe. So it forces you to create a profile and then to do that prioritization because, okay, if we could only accomplish 5 things this year, then what would we want to, what could we do? If you are identifying professionals in the community where you are in terms of outreach, now we're talking, because in terms of transforming culture, especially in the church's environment, you're looking at 2 different places where planning needs to occur. Internally, to equip people for works of ministry, train and equip people for works of ministry, Ephesians 4:12. And externally, reaching out to the world with the precious message of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which can in fact transform lives and hence transform culture. Because salt and light transform. Light brings illumination to the darkness, and salt brings flavor to the table and preservation to the table. And that's what preserving or transforming culture, from my perspective, really means. So it's happening at 2 levels, okay? But never more than 5 objectives. I'm going to give you an internal example in conjunction with working male seniors, my church. I'm going to give you some external examples of how that played out, practically in the context of our community as we began to do the same thing. So never more than 5 things. And never ask a volunteer to do more than 5 assignments during a year. In other words, the key to success organizationally is really managing, volunteers appropriately. How do we really manage these people? And, we tend, and this is true with organizations, if you get a good volunteer, you tend to abuse them. We'll get them to do as much as they'll do until they crash and burn. Then when they crash and burn, we'll go find somebody else to do it. Well, the realities are, that's damaging, obviously, to the person. But it's also damaging to your organization. We can't do it ourselves. I mean, the challenge, as I pointed out earlier, if you're reaching your community for Christ, as long as that's your challenge, it probably will never occur. And eventually, you'll crash and burn. And that's just life, and we've all seen it happen, haven't you? I've had 35 years of sitting in the front row seat of a national theater watching people die all the time, watching people in this profession just basically crash and burn. And to me, that's very, very tragic because we're losing some of the shining stars that have the opportunity of really being able to impact ministries and what it is that they've committed themselves to do before the Lord. Okay, so with those kind of organizational thoughts in mind, let's go back to working male seniors. Okay, and by the way, from about this point on, if you were to look at the notes, we're starting to pull together what it is that I tried to say in the notes. But essentially, we're a lot of the seminars that I do are built upon. Usually I'll have people for, like 10 or 15 or 20 hours, and so everything, is kind of built onto something else. And so this is kind of a topic, transforming culture, that was essentially built around, 6 or 7 lectures that I had done before, and so that's why it was so essential, I thought, to go through some of the preliminary steps that we've taken. All right, my pastor kind of created the profile. And so we came up with 5 objectives. Remember, never more than 5 objectives in conjunction with every major initiative. The major initiative is we're going to work with working male seniors this year. The 5 objectives were specifically, we wanted every single one of our guys that were willing to participate in this program to have an accountability partner. We just felt that that was important. Because if we're going to maintain integrity, if we're going to maintain the opportunity for our, ministry to have, real impact, then the realities are, we have to have accountability.
we thought that having a mentoring relationship, you know, would be pretty important, that these men would be mentoring other younger men. We felt that that would be good for the spirituality, the opportunity of discipling and so forth, which is so biblically relevant, obviously. So mentoring was perceived as being important. We thought a Bible study, you know, that these guys could take together, maybe on the themes of worldview, because you know, that was one of the things that really concerns our pastor, is that we really understand what our worldview is, because we have one. And most people, you know, think about adopting one, but the realities are what we need to do probably is more reform ours, so it's more consistent with what it is that the scriptures have to say. But nonetheless, we talked about a little bit about that. And then there were some other things, like maybe having a quarterly breakfast meeting. We'd like to get together with these guys on a quarterly basis to, you know, kind of assess, you know, progress that's being made. And we have a men's retreat at our church, and we thought, well, gee, if all these older guys came to the men's retreat, you know, that would be wonderful, because, you know, obviously they're the people that others are looking to. I mean, they're older, they have gray hair or white hair, and they have, you know, a lifetime of experience of walking with the Lord, and they've probably, you know, learned how to take the frustrations and the anxieties of life and be able to process those and still come out strong. So those were five objectives.
Can I just ask mm-hmm. you about that? Because your objectives there in terms of activity, but I suspect what triggered it off was a sense of how do we give to working male seniors a sense of significance and worth within the church.
Exactly.
Exactly.
See, I I'm glad you asked that question, because really what motivated me to do this more than anything else is I was feeling left out. I mean, I'm in a church of 1,500 people, and I'm traveling 200 days a year. And so I'm feeling left out in the context of the very body of believers that I'm depending upon to equip me and to train me and to support me in works of ministry. And the realities are probably half the guys on that list were feeling the same way. And see, that's what's happening. It's easy. You can easily get lost in an organization, especially the size of your organization. You can easily get lost in an organization and feel comfortable in that lost position. But in reality, kind of having this incredible desire, but not knowing how to kind of scratch where it itches, so to speak. That's certainly part of a larger plan, because, you know, first of all, to the degree that we're successful in doing this, it's going to enable us more effectively to mobilize these people in terms of, you know, reaching out to the world of which they're a part. Because I think the key to transforming culture is this, that I have a world and you have a world. See, we all have a world. And I think the challenge to us as believers is to know our world, to be able to define our world, and then to go to our world with a plan of seeking to reach our world with the message of the gospel. And that's kind of what happened to me in this whole process, is that, you know, as I was kind of thinking through this at a level that was different than I had ever thought through it before, I'm looking at myself and my world, at least part of my world, is my neighborhood. And that's when I said to my wife, you know, if I were to die tomorrow, nobody would care. And she says, yeah, you're probably right. And so what am I going to do about that? Well, what we did is I just said to Sue one day, I says, you know, I think God wants us to start a Bible study in our community. I think God's calling me to do that. And she says, well, everybody in our neighborhood's a Jew. You know, they're all Jewish, and, you know, and I says, yeah, that's probably why we need to begin a Bible study. And so, well, how are we going to do that? So, you know, basically what we did was we started sending out, I actually wrote a letter to everybody in my neighborhood and invited them to come to a picnic if they had any interest at all in doing a Bible study. You know, I had no idea how anybody would respond. Well, you know, we had a picnic. We had about 20 people show up. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to do a Bible study. Let's just get together once a month. You know, we can talk about the Lord and talk about the Word of God and so forth. And anybody interested? They all raised their hands. And so for the last year, we've had 20 people in our house every week, you know, and it's a part of a bigger plan of my desire to see these people come to know Christ. And
you know, this next year, did you all meet Michael Ramsden? Michael is an apologist, and he works with Ravi Zacharias Ministries, and so. Pardon me? Oh gosh, I hate to see you leave. I hope that we got a little tidbits of stuff here, and I would, I'm telling you, I would absolutely, you know, relish the fact if you ever have a meeting sometime to come and to challenge you in terms of ways that you can really impact culture, because the United Kingdom should be different because we've got 5,000 doctors that are.
When are you next in the UK?
Probably sometime this fall, actually. UCCF is talking about having me come. They need to go to phase two, but let's stay in communication.
I'd like to get you
let's do it. So thank you so much, brother. It's really so good, Chris, to have you with us. The 11:45 bus. You don't want to miss the bus because it's taking you to a place where you need to be in order to get home. And there's nothing more enjoyable than getting home. So thanks, Chris. Blessings to you, my brother.
I guess all your contact details are on the website.
They should be. They should be there. So.
I'll find you.
Okay. Grab one of those evaluation forms on the way out and at least send it back if you can't quickly fill it out in relationship to this particular program. Okay. Now, what we did here, interestingly enough, is, and I think this is where this planning model plays out in virtually everything that you do, is we created a profile of the perfect accountability relationship. We created a profile for the perfect mentoring relationship. Because, you know, in reality, most people don't know how to be an accountability partner. And if you've ever been in a situation where you're, you know, well, you know, you sense the need for being accountable to somebody, and so you ask somebody, well, can we have this kind of relationship? And so you go to the first meeting, and nobody knows what to say. You know, well, did you sin this week? Yeah, well, that's not good. You know, you shouldn't do that, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, it kind of feels a little awkward, you know, because we're really not knowing how to handle it. And so essentially, you know, a profiling this might result in creating some kind of a covenant that you're making with one another, you know, basically defining what it is that you're going to be accountable for, questions that you might ask. And so everybody understands it from the beginning, the same way with the mentoring, same way with the Bible study and so forth. Now, the way it played out from an organizational standpoint is this. We had 25 guys. Now, we had 60 in the group, and so it's easier to divide them into, you know, this is a fairly large group, and you may not have a group nearly this size. But we had 25 guys in this outside circle, and each of those guys has a name. You know, this is John, this is Larry, this is Jim, this is, you know, Jerry, or whatever the case might be. We had, we divided by five, so we had five guys in the center area. So these guys all have a name. This is Jack, and this is George, this is Fred, this is Jim, and this is Friedolf, you know, okay? And so, and then in the middle, we have another person. Let's say this is Jerry, okay? Now, the objectives, obviously, is to accomplish these five things, you know, in the context of the year. And so, basically, you know, my pastor, you know, for the sake of illustration, you know, is one who's basically pouring his life into me. Let's say that this is me. So Tom, who's my pastor, is just, you know, here's what it is that we really would like to see us do this year and so forth. I go out and identify five guys that I can work with because these are the guys that I'm going to be discipling this year. And essentially, I go out with those five guys and say, you know, will you help us in this particular initiative? And essentially, each one of those five guys have identified five others that they're going to be working with in the context of this year. So essentially, that's the way the organizational chart looks. But let me tell you, in terms of commitment, and by the way, you have to understand that this is not a small group. You know, this group essentially never meets, with the exception of this, you know, quarterly breakfast that they might get together, you know, once a quarter. So it's not a small group. This is not in lieu of small groups, or it's not, you know, basically what I'm suggesting is that if you were to, let's look at these objectives and accountability. What essentially we're suggesting is that you know, these guys get together once a month with somebody for a breakfast or lunch. You know, if you're willing to do this, you know, this is what it's going to involve. So this is one, let's say 1 hour a month. You know, so there's, you know, basically, but you're going to eat breakfast anyway. Or you know, typically you're going to have coffee, something, or you're going to do things. So it's not really intended to be a real stretch in your calendar. You're not asking people to, you know, come to a meeting and do anything. We're suggesting that this happen once a quarter, that we get together with this individual on a quarterly basis. This is just something that we're going to do. It's a small Bible study that maybe it takes 15 minutes or 20 minutes a week to do. It's something that we designed or would design, that would be designed to accomplish a particular objective. Obviously, this happens on a quarterly basis, and this men's retreat happens once a year, you know, on a weekend. So what we were essentially asking men to do is to make a commitment. Do you want to be a part of this, number one? This is what it is that we're going to do. This is what it's going to require of you. And it's totally voluntary. And, you know, they're saying, that sounds like fun. I mean, I think I would like to do that. Now, what these guys in the middle circle do, you know, what we're asking them to do in relationship to these five men may take them no more than, you know, five phone calls, you know, once a quarter or something like that, where they're just going to call and say, well, you know, how's the accountability thing going? You know, is there any problems that you're having? Is it working out? Are you getting together on a regular basis? But even those calls are planned. You know, in other words, you should be at lesson 14 now, you know, you're on schedule. You know, have you met with your mentoring partner and so forth, and how's that going? And so, you know, by the way, the next prayer breakfast or the next quarterly breakfast is going to be on, you know, October the 12th over at Jerry's house. And don't forget, you know, marking your calendar November 5th and 6th. That's all that they do. But imagine, and this is the point that I want to make, imagine that these five things are being accomplished in the life of every working male senior. You know, think how much further ahead we would be in terms of ministry than we would be, you know, if this wasn't the case. So, you know, you can play it out in so many different ways. But to take it another step further, you know, I have my world out here, and my world, you know, is my community. And I know the 60 households, let's say, of people that live, you know, in the community where I live. And if I could only accomplish five objectives this year, you know, what five objectives would I want to accomplish? And really seeking to bring, now remember all of this, remember this, you know, all those decisions that people could make, and remember this, you know, the house on the hill. Well, obviously, you know, I have built relationships with at least 10 couples who have come to my house, who have attended something. And so essentially now these people that were all, you know, for all practical purposes, as it relates to me and as it relates to, you know, what it is that I was seeking to accomplish, they were all D's. I mean, they'd never attended anything. They'd never been involved. They'd never made... Well, now all of the people, at least 10 couples, you know, where a year ago they were non-vested D's, 10 of these couples are probably, you know, vested A's. Now, when you're looking at the potential of really being able to impact these people in real significant ways and bringing them to a relationship into Christ, we're far more likely to have them responsive to opportunities. But, you know, now I'm trying to take them down this trail that brings them to a point of commitment to Jesus. You know, and well, we've been studying the Bible. That's a good step. We've been bearing one another's burdens. That's another step that we've been taking. You know, I've been to more funerals this year than I've been in a long time, and I'm going to funerals of loved ones of my members. We actually had one in our group that lost her mother. I lost my mother, and they supported me in some very interesting ways. We've had another one in the neighborhood that lost her daughter, who wasn't a part of our group, but our group kind of really came together and really reached out to help them. But ministry is taking place, but it's taking place strategically. Now, Michael Ramsden, the reason I use Michael Ramsden as an example is Mike is just an incredible apologist. He's a Brit. He's involved with Ravi Zacharias ministry and so forth. And so he's coming to Indianapolis, you know, in October. Well, I'm telling you, I'm going to take brochures around to about 300 households, you know, in my immediate neighborhood, outside my neighborhood to the some of the surrounding neighborhoods and saying, you know, come on over. You know, here's this guy who's been to the White House, who's talked to kings and rulers and leaders and nations all around the earth. And, you know, it's an incredible opportunity for them to be exposed. And I'm just praying that that's going to take them one step further along the way. But the bottom line is, you know, the bottom line is, that I really believe that many of these neighbors are going to come to know Christ. And not because, you know, I don't want to overstate this point, but I certainly want to make the point, is that 2 years ago, I didn't even have a plan. I didn't have the foggiest idea how to reach my neighbors. But all of a sudden, I realized that God had given me a world and He'd given me a platform. And He's given me more than one world. I mean, I have a world with our clients and I have other things to do. And just imagine, but think of the multiplication. Think of the fact that we have 60 working male seniors, all who have a world who are doing the same thing. And all of a sudden, you know, because I'm not concerned, the goal is transforming culture. But practically speaking, transforming culture is accomplished through transformed people. And so I realize that if culture is going to be meaningfully transformed in the ways that I think are consistent with God's desires for us, then the realities are it's going to begin with people being transformed by the renewing work of the Spirit of God in their lives. And in the book Transforming Culture that I wrote, it's an allegory. And basically, it tells the story of a church, you know, that's been transformed and is being used of the Lord to transform culture. And so the allegory is between, it basically means that I'm telling a story between, you know, the pastor of the church and a church and somebody that's investigating the church. He's a newspaper writer who basically is, you know, taking on a challenge to investigate this church that's obviously transforming culture. So he goes and he does this. And so the pastor just kind of walks him through all these steps. Well, this is the way we do it. This is what it is we do internally. This is what it is we do externally. He gives lots of examples. And one of the things that he says, you know, we bring people to the front porch and then we extend the invitation to come in, you know, that little illustration. And the newspaper reporter looks and he says, well, for crying out loud, not everybody's going to come in. You know, if you extend an invitation, he says, yeah, but nobody will come in, you know, if you don't extend the invitation. But usually, from an evangelist standpoint, the invitation is to respond to Christ. But there are lots of other invitations along the way that people, you know, as they see and they perceive needs, you know, begin to think, oh, yeah, and they take one step. And I think our neighbors in our neighborhood have taken, you know, some baby steps, and I'm okay with that. Because I believe that, you know, our goal is to bring them to exposure to the opportunity to respond to Christ. And we're really trusting God that He will transform, you know, the culture of our neighborhood through the work that we're doing. So, you know, how you use this, let me just kind of take a look at these notes here and see how well we've done. And we don't, you know, what the success looks like, you know, that's the profiling process. What natural steps need to occur to achieve it? That's kind of defining, you know, well, if this is to be successful, what needs to happen? And so basically, you know, essentially we're walking you through that. What groups are critical to achieve it? Now we're identifying our critical groups. And then we need to prioritize those groups and come up with the top five. Defining your plan, profile one of your critical groups. You know, that's what Pastor Tom did in my situation. You know, what is the... You know, the perfect, you know, if we were totally successful in fulfilling what it is we want to do with working male seniors, what would they look like? Assess where you are. Well, I mean, if I were to assess where we were probably at a C minus. You know, well, what can you, what needs to occur? Well, the pastor helped me and others to define, you know, that an accountability relationship, a mentoring relationship, all of those things would really be pretty important. Now, who are the critical members of the critical group? They became the center circle people, you know, this one and this one here. And let me just kind of talk through that a little bit. The realities are that every group has critical members, you know, people that others look to for direction. they're the movers and shakers in the group, you know, the people that kind of shape the opinions of other people. And so, you know, to the extent that you can engage them in helping you to implement your plan, the more successful you're going to be, because these people hold the respect of the other people down in the outside circle in terms of, you know, they're being looked at. And then organize and implement the plan and then track it. The scopes of ministry that we've talked about, you know, as we've passed through this is Ephesians chapter 4, working, training people and equipping people for works of ministry. So that's the internal work that needs to be done within the context of the church. The external work is we need to reach the world, starting in Jerusalem, which is my neighborhood, Judea, which is the, you know, the general area, Samaria and the innermost parts of the earth. I talk about in Roman numeral 5, and I don't want to get into some of the details. I would like to talk a little bit about spiritual giftedness, but transforming culture, salt and light, the roles that they play in the world, and to the extent that we are truly salt and we are truly light in the communities, then culture will change. All of a sudden, you know, light, you know, brings illumination to darkness. And as people see darkness, especially redeemed people seek darkness, they seek to do the things that need to be done in order to change darkness. And so hence, you know, a transformation. Light brings salt brings preservation and taste and, you know, helps enhance, you know, something in terms of its value. So salt and light are transforming features of change. And then the fingerprint of your presence, you know, essentially what I'm trying to say is what it is that I said earlier to you. I mean, if I were to die, if your church was to disappear, if Tyndale Seminary was to disappear tomorrow, would it make any difference to anybody? And I think we have to be really serious about answering that question. I mean, is the fingerprint of the presence of what's happening evangelically in Eastern Europe, and, you know, does it have we been an integral part in that happening? In other words, can we track back how we've been involved strategically? I mean, if does the community, you know, 15 years from now, will it have the stamp of the fact that you were there everywhere? You see it in business, you see it in the professions, you see it there. I mean, is it there? And so I think, you know, one of the serious questions that every ministry has to ask is, for crying out loud, I mean, if we were to disappear, would it make any difference to anybody? And I conclude that if I were to die, you know, frankly, nobody in my neighborhood would really care. You know, I wonder who's going to buy that house, you know. And, you know, I wonder what happens going to happen to his wife, you know. Or I'll sure miss seeing that guy running down the street waving to everybody. I mean, gosh, I mean, is that how we want to be remembered? Heavens, no. Spiritual giftedness, the only point that I really wanted to make there is the fact that I think all of us have to be comfortable with how God has wired us. And a little personal testimony for what it's worth. I don't think it was until I was about 40 that I really became comfortable with who it is I was or who it is that I am. I have a very close friend that I've known, you know, for most of my adult life. He's with the Lord now, and he was a very, very good friend of mine. And I remember one day we were riding down the road, and he said to me, he said, you know, you really do something. And he mentioned something that I do, and he says, you know, you really do that really good. You really do that well. And I said, yeah, well, thanks. You know, and I never even thought too much about it. He says, no, I want you to stop and think about that. And essentially what he asked me was this. He said, Jerry, he says, you do that well. And basically I got a little upset with you because you just shrugged that off. I says, well, anybody could do that. He says, that's the point. Not everybody could do that. And the reason that you can shrug your shoulders is because it comes so easy to you that essentially, you know, it's not work. And he says, what I would like to encourage you to do is this. Think about that as maybe that's God's gift. You know, I think, you know, spiritually, you know, when we talk about spiritual gifts, we kind of, you know, have some lists in mind that are found in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans chapter 12. We kind of relegate the fact that, you know, God gave gifts and this is what they are. But the realities are God's gift in this is far broader than that. He says, think about your gift. He says, look at that as a gift. And if, in fact, it is a gift from God, then you have a stewardship responsibility and you need to answer the question, how are you going to use that gift to further the cause of the kingdom of God? And let me tell you something, that was transformational in my life. Because all of a sudden, that thing which I had basically repudiated, for lack of a better term, because I didn't, see it as being significant at all of a sudden I saw that as being very, very significant to what it is that God would have me to do. And, I think when we act in our area of giftedness, then God blesses us. But, up to that particular point in my life, I was trying to be like somebody else. I there were people that I admired that I tried to emulate in terms of my life practices. And, that wasn't bad. I mean, they were godly people who were doing significant things, and I was trying to be like them. And it wasn't until probably I was 40 years old that I became comfortable with who it is that I am. And I think that needs to happen in all of our lives. And so I would just really encourage you, as I've tried to encourage people, wherever I go, is to stop long enough to ask yourself the question, when people look at me and sometimes they compliment me and my first response is to shrug my shoulders, stop there and let that be a reminder. Whoops, what did I just shrug my shoulders at? Because what it is they complimented me on is something that is so easy for me to do that it's not even, it's just like getting out of bed. It's like water flowing off a duck's back. It really does not take energy for me. Well, I would challenge you to ask yourself the question, is that God's gift to me? And then if in fact you perceive that to be the case, then ask yourself the question, how can I use it most effectively to impact the kingdom of God? And maybe it's writing, maybe it's a lot of other things. There's all kinds of places or things that, that might fall into. But transforming culture is a pretty important thing, and it seems to me that, so often we think about, well, what am I going to do this week? But we don't think about the broader cultural ramifications of how that should play out in the context of my life, and that's the purpose of what it is we're talking about here today. So I'm done. If we have any questions or whatever, we can talk about those or discuss the relevance of this. This is the time to do it.
I just have a technical question. You had the three steps of bringing people into the organization, entry, then bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Then you talked about assumptions and other things. I didn't catch what the third one was.
Well, the third one is, it's conversion. And essentially what that means is, how many people that you have brought to the front door, let's say that, Pavel has a ministry and 100 people come to the Christmas candlelight service, people from the community. So they all came to the front door. And, Pavel, starting to apply some of the things that he's learned, and he says, okay, I want to, here are four or five ways that you could, we're going to do some community, we're calling them coffee house Bible studies, and they're interdenominational. We just really would like you to come if you have an interest and so forth. So, let's say 25 of the 50 people that came said, well, I want to be, then you've had a 50% conversion rate. And so the point of tracking conversion only, you track conversion, which you should track in conjunction with everything that you're doing. How many of the people that came to the front porch, how many came into the house. The reason that you track it is because it will show you whether or not how well you're doing on the bridging thing. The biggest mistake that is made in development today, and I think I'm in a position to be able to make this statement, I think the biggest mistake that is made in development today is the failure to bridge. We bring, literally, if you stop and evaluate your ministry, especially say at Tyndall, you've brought thousands of people to the front porch. Thousands of people have been exposed in one form or another to your ministry. And if you haven't bridged, you've missed significant developmental opportunities because you let people walk away without inviting them to come in. And that's tragic because that's missed opportunity. And so, pretty important stuff. Other questions? Sorry I had to take you through Robin Hood's barn or around the barn or whatever to get you into the, finally into the stall that I wanted to take you. But it seemed to me that, because, we haven't been together all week, we've been in various sessions and so forth, that to building a case for, an organizational case for transforming culture had to precede, you know, talking about the intricacies of how that effectively happens, you know, in an organization. I'm excited about Tyndall, and I'm excited about what it is that you're doing. And I hope that, you know, as you're putting together plans and so forth, you'd feel free to interact with me and, you know, send me an email and say, hey, Jerry, I'm doing this. You know, would you evaluate it or assess it? I would be happy to do that, and there's certainly no charge to do that, obviously. Let me give you some contact information for whatever it's worth. My email address, and I would certainly welcome, and this is probably, you know, this is the one thing that we can all do, because it's, you know, most of us have that kind of capacity, obviously. Jerry@dmagroup.org. So that's pretty easy to remember. DMA is the name of our company. It's called Development Marketing Associates. And our website, obviously, is www.dmagroup.org. And one of the things we're doing this year, and it's actually happening in September, we're doing a course that you can take over the internet, and I would really encourage you to, you know, check out our website. It's not there now. You just keep at it, though, because we're doing some major changes to our website right now. But in September, we're doing a one-year course, and there are 40 lessons. The title of the course is Developing Organizations of Impact or something like that. And there are it's over 10 months, and there every week there's a lesson, and then that's followed by, you know, some short assignments, and it will take you, I mean, the lessons are basically PowerPoint presentations that will take you probably, you know, 8 to 10 minutes to listen to. And you can download, and then there's some assignments, but it's designed over time that, you know, over 40 weeks, you could really make some substantive progress in building infrastructure to support a very successful ministry. And I'd encourage you to take that course. And basically, it's a package, so it includes this one-year program where over, you know, 10 months and 40 lessons that you're going to be further down the road than you perhaps are now. And then there are three additional courses that are independent self-study courses that are included in there. And those courses are, one is entitled The Process of Development, the other one is entitled An Introduction to Relational Development, and the third course is entitled Creating a Developmental Calendar. So those three courses are included in this. And you can take those, and anybody in your organization can take those courses. In other words, you may say, well, let's just do this together. And so you've got, you know, Henry and others of you that are taking them together. And so it gives you some opportunity to kind of interacting. And you may have some people in your church that say, well, let's do this one together. There's a cost attached to it, which is $500 US for the year. But essentially, we're also providing some scholarship what I want you to do, I'm not concerned about the money. I'm concerned about the fact that you take that course. And so, you know, there's a scholarship application that you can fill out that basically says, well, you know, we'll give you X number of dollars so that it can be affordable to you. But and there probably will be a charge, but it will be slight, only to reflect. And basically we allow you to say what it is that you feel you could afford to do rather than, so you can kind of determine what that might be and what's going to be possible for you. But, you know, we think it's important for people to pay something because then they take it seriously. If it's free, then you just kind of say, yeah, it's just there, but I don't do it. Part of this deal is that every quarter or so, we have an internet classroom, which is really kind of neat, so you can go on the internet and type in a website, and it'll take you right into a classroom where I can speak to you, and we can kind of talk back and forth. If you have a microphone, you can talk and participate in discussions and so forth. But it will allow us the opportunity of periodically interacting and saying, well, gee, this isn't working here, Jerry. I mean, it may work someplace else, but it's not working here. And we can kind of talk through those situations so that we don't lose contact. You know, one of the frustrations that I've had with the forum which is not the forum's fault. I mean, because I have this problem with a lot of places that I go. And that is, you know, we have a great experience. You know, we learn and we grow and we become, you know, hopefully professionally better than we were than when we came. But then we kind of slip back into the valley of the shadow of death. You know, we go back to where we come from, and, you know, we lose a lot of the motivation, or a lot of the stuff that began doesn't really come to fruition. And so this provides us a means of maintaining some ongoing contact. So you may want to take a look at that. Really encourage you to do that. I got to give you this. This is part of my responsibility, so I apologize, but if you could just take a few minutes. This is to talk about the post-forum seminar. And pass that down. That would be great. And for those of you that have listened in, I'm going to say goodbye.